We live? Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the JAC. January 17th, 8:30. January, Craig, update. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I should first begin by introducing Dan Noble to my right. He was appointed by Governor Mead a few weeks ago to serve as the new co-chair for the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group. With the departure of Bill Mai and the departure of Ryan Lands from the Office of State Lands, there have been a couple of openings on the Craig Group since we last met in October. Dan Noble was appointed by the governor to serve as co-chair, and the co-chairs have elected to have Bill Mai continue his 25 years of service to the Craig, as well as elevate Winland Liu, who is the interim administrator for the Economic Analysis Division, to that Craig group. I sit before you this morning with a slightly different hat than my usual LSO staff, and that is to present the consensus revenue update to the October report. The bottom line I'll jump to right away.
But before you do, Don, Dan, welcome. And it's we're glad to have you here in this capacity. And let's see, Mr. Co-Chair, we'll allow him to blame it on the previous guys for, what, about 10 minutes? What do you think?
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
Do you have any comments you'd like to make?
I'd like to thank everyone that supported this appointment. I talked with the governor yesterday, and apparently there were folks that were supportive of this. And I will tell you this, I will take this as an extremely important position as it is, and will give it my best.
Yeah, well, thanks and welcome. You know, this is sort of the Bible as to what we do and how we run our state, because without the money to pay for all this government that we have, we find ourselves in a precarious situation. And some would say that maybe we're a little too conservative in how we approach this. I would say we're probably not conservative enough, but that's just one person's opinion. So it's worked pretty well, and it's always easier to have a little extra money than to be short. And I know you have that philosophy, and Don certainly does as well. So any questions, committee, of either gentleman before we start? You've just been given the information. So, okay, Don, go ahead.
Sure. Jumping to the punchline first, the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group added $51.9 million to the traditional funds. That's the general fund and the budget reserve account. $28.6 million of that was in 13 and 14, so the remainder of this biennium. And $23.3 million was in the subsequent biennium 15-16. All of those funds are available for expenditure or savings as the legislature determines. The three items that were officially modified by Craig included an increase in the forecast for sales and use tax. We increased that by $6.9 million for the current fiscal year, $14.7 for fiscal year 15, and $18.8 million each year for the last 3 years of the projection period. This comes about from two standpoints. First of all, we have experienced a documented increase in personal income that we monitor throughout the state, and we've received indications of a modest increase in oil and gas employment. Those two factors are the largest contributors to our sales and use tax forecasting model. So you will recall that the Craig reduced sales and use tax expectations in October, and we're building back some of that increase in given the last quarter of performance. That is the largest increase in terms of revenue components. With respect to minerals, the group reduced the coal price, but fairly modestly, 25 cents a ton for calendar year 14 and 15. That moves the coal projected price from $13.75 a ton to $13.50 a ton for only 2 years. We were sitting on $13.50 this year, and we are going to be just shy of our estimate. The spot prices have declined precipitously in the past 18 to 24 months, but they have bottomed out, and we believe that they have rebounded, and, in fact, they are starting to increase. least
what
on
about volumes?
On the volumes, those remained unchanged in terms of our forecast. We forecast 385 million tons for calendar year 13. We don't have all of our volume data in, but the federal government receives projections earlier than the state does, and they showed that Wyoming production was 384 or 386 million, within a million tons of our projection. Going forward, we had reduced the projected volumes dramatically in October, and we are projecting 400 million tons in calendar year 14 and throughout the projection period. There is possibility that that is slightly overestimated in the near term and underestimated in the out years. As part of our information gathering by various members, we do talk to coal companies. We talk about what they project, and we also visit analyst sites and proprietary projections by other firms. We're certainly in the neighborhood of the other projections that we review, although we might be slightly low. On the flip side, increases in natural gas prices tend to reduce the substitution effect for the production of electricity from coal to natural gas. So we're hopeful that this summer and the remaining part of calendar year 14, we will have a slight uptick in coal production. We also looked at inventories at utilities around the nation and believe that there's an opportunity for some additional replenishment of those inventories.
So what you've done, you said 385 for fiscal year or calendar year 2013, then you're back up to 400 for 14-15 and then on out. It's hard to be optimistic about volumes when you see the attack that we continue to be under for coal. And you know, the latest, you know, rule that they proposed on, 1,000 pounds of CO2 per 1 megawatt hour generated electricity just pretty much eliminates any new coal-fired power plants. And, of course, there are existing rules coming. And so, you know, you'll have a shot at it in October. I guess that'll be the next time you do it. But I think you're probably a little higher than I would feel comfortable with. And then the volumes on natural gas, I sent you a thing about prices. They are firming up a little bit because of the cold winter we've experienced in the east. And so that might offset the volumes. I think you're probably a little too light on as well. So I think it's probably all in all pretty accurate. Go ahead.
Mr.
Anybody
Chairman,
else have a question on volumes or prices?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
President Vescoel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, kind of looking at one of our graphs, and the highest we've ever been on coal looks like about 480 million tons. Is that about right?
January, that's when you're supposed to get.
Is that the highest we've ever been?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's slightly lower than that, but in the ballpark, 460 to 470. We reduced, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we reduced the forecast by tens of millions of tons over the past 18 to 24 months. The 385 is certainly low, and I think, well, you hear it on the news as recently as last night regarding the EPA regulations and the potential impact that will have. It is quite possible that this summer, if those regulations do come to fruition, that it will have a significant and negative impact on coal production. On the other side, and this is probably out much further, there is some opportunity in the export of coal. Neither of those two are included in our forecast.
Just to follow up, what about the possibilities of more eastern coal being replaced by our Powder River coal?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, that is certainly a possibility. We have not yet seen that, in my opinion, when you look at the Energy Information Administration federal data. It shows that the Powder River Basin coal is declining at roughly the same rate as national coal. So I recognize that there are many advantages of Wyoming coal with respect to sulfur and access to markets, but we have not yet seen that significant replacements. What I will say is the likelihood of utility shutdowns in the electric generation area are probably more likely those that receive eastern coal than Powder River Basin coal, but both are possible.
You know, one of the things in that vein, too, is when you look at a lot of the eastern coal-fired power plants that, that were set up to use eastern coal, they didn't really retrofit, and they can't just switch to natural gas like a lot of the ones that are further west, mainly because there was the supply of gas was so restricted. But now with the Marcellus Shale and a lot of the gas that's available in the east, you might see some of these retrofitting. But I don't see that, and so it's going to be interesting to see what happens with these coal-fired power plants in the future. I think we've gone from, Don, what is it, about 47% of our electrical generation was by coal a couple of years ago. That is now down to 39%, of which it's all been replaced by natural gas. Uranium or nuclear power is just about operating about 94 or 95% efficiency and doing about 21%. So, and I think wind has picked up a huge percentage, like 0.035 or some number. No, I don't know what wind's done. Okay, Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, could you go back back up just a little bit? You had said some of the indicators on the increased projections from Craig were the documented personal income increases. I'd like you to expound on that just a little bit more, if you don't mind. You said that, if I heard you right, it says it was an increase in sales and use tax. What was the percentage of, was there like a percentage raise in personal income that you saw?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, we had declines in personal income in some of the quarters. It's a quarterly number in the past 2 years. And I believe the numbers have been 1.5% for about the last 2 quarters. If you annualize that number, meaning 1.5 multiplied by 4, you get slightly over 5%. Now, we have not had consecutive year-over-year growth of 5%, but we have indications that we are no longer having declines, and we've had a couple of quarters in the 1.5% personal income growth area. As a result of that, we have multiple regression models, high, low, and best-case scenario. And so we put those likelihood of increased personal income into those models, which resulted in what I would say a pretty modest increase. You know, $8 million, $14 million in sales tax collection to the general fund, but it's not substantial increase.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, before jumping to the last item that Craig changed, I wanted to touch base just briefly on the items that we did not change. Doesn't mean we didn't evaluate them. We kept oil production and price where it is. Our production is increasing, as indicated in many press reports. We incorporated pretty sizable increases in October, and now the question is, do we have the slope of that line correct? And it appears to us that, at least in the near term, that slope is meeting our expectations. The oil price is sitting at $85 a barrel. We're probably a little bit high on our oil price today. WTI is around $94, $95 a barrel today, but that doesn't take into account the differential of, say, $15, $16 between WTI and Wyoming production. So we're satisfied with where we're at, but that is a potential risk to our forecast is the price of oil. On the natural gas side, we significantly reduced production over the past year, and we've essentially gone from an increasing slope to a flat line, and now we have a decreasing slope in terms of our forecasted natural gas production. Now our question is, once again, do we have the slope of that decline right? And based upon the most recent information, we believe that we are pretty close to that slope. It is possible that it might be more of a U and less of a V, which means that it will reduce quicker than we anticipated, but might not go as deep. It will be a shallower reduction, but we're comfortable with our projection where it sits. On the price side, you know, when you look out today, Opal natural gas was selling at $4.53 per MMBTU. That's $1 above where we were last year on a comparative basis, and that's about 80 cents or so above where our forecast is. I'll also remind you this is probably the high point in the calendar cycle, so our projection is for an annual. So I often get calls in May and March when we have $3.60 gas, and people say, are you going to reduce the Craig forecast? And then in the winter, you see that we are definitely under the forecast now, and they said, well, why aren't you increasing it? Well, keep in mind you have to smooth the peaks and the valleys out, and we'll probably end a calendar year 13 slightly low, which means we'll have some additional revenue over our forecast. But going forward, we have built in some pretty aggressive pricing increases, and given the environment, we like the weather. The cold weather is helping us, but the long-term story still has not changed, at least in my opinion, and that is substantial increases in supply from other states.
Yeah, and Don, on the pricing scenario, the good news is the differential in gas is really marginal. The bad news on oil, it's becoming more and more of a player. So I think this morning the NYMEX was $92 for crude, but you've got about a $16 differential. So the 85 is optimistic. And that differential, unless they do the Keystone Express or some of these other lines, as they continue to drill in the Bakken, it only puts more pressure on the crude out of Wyoming, which only puts more pressure on driving the price down. So yeah, I know you have that in the back of your mind. Keep that there.
Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Just out of curiosity, when I look at Table 3 on the Craig, on your surface coal production, you've got it at 385 for 2013, but then you've actually in the out years, you're projecting 400,000, but I thought you just said you were worried about production declines, but they don't seem to be reflected in your surface coal number. You got 400 million tons going out.
Go ahead, Don.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, on the surface coal, we do believe that we will have a rebound from the 385. On natural gas, we believe that the decline will continue. We may not have the slope of the decline perfect on the natural gas side, but we think we're very close. On the surface coal, I think what I intended to articulate is that in the near term, we may not rebound quite as quickly. But if you look out further, there's opportunity for increased production. All of this is contingent upon the federal regulations on coal-fired electric generation plants. One more item that Craig certainly discussed, a revenue component, is investment earnings. And we did not make any changes, but I did want to bring to the committee's attention that we have the State Treasurer's Office has not changed its October 13 revenue projections for the forecast period. However, they note that the first 5 months of fiscal year 14 have been particularly challenging for the fixed income portfolio. Dividend and interest income is running slightly off pace to the low side, but it is expected to hit the target within the fiscal year across all funds. Fixed income managers have realized capital losses. We are holding over $20 million in capital losses in the state agency pool, of which $13-14 million of that is attributable to the general fund. On the permanent mineral trust fund side, we are holding $100 million in capital gains, largely from the equity side of our portfolio. Those gains are not included in Craig's forecast, but would be available at the end of the fiscal year should they remain positive. The negative capital losses, or the capital losses on the fixed income side, are somewhat offside by the gains in the equity portfolios, but the state agency pool doesn't invest in equities. As a result, if they're not made up before the end of the year, these will carry over. It will not affect the income from dividends and interest in their distribution, but according to the Treasurer's Office policy, those losses will be carried over into future gains or future years until such time gains are realized.
Continue. I'll ask in a second.
The last component that Craig included, and the profile adds to is the issue of the federal sequestration. In October, we included no impacts of the federal sequestration. You'll recall, if you look back 3 months, we were in a fair bit of turmoil in Congress. We were looking forward to a government shutdown, no agreement on a budget. We received three different guidance letters from the federal administration over the prior 4 years, and Craig basically held fast. The good news to report is that the federal government restored Wyoming's sequestered federal mineral revenues that are attributable to federal state fiscal year 13 to the tune of $46.5 million, and they are included now in Craig. We've included them to the budget reserve account, $25 million, to the school foundation program, $12.6 million, and to the school capital construction program, $8.8 million. They made good on their restoration of the sequester, which I would refer to as a withholding, and Craig has incorporated them in their green sheets. The challenge for us is now what? In October, November, December, the federal government has withheld 8% of our federal mineral revenue stream. That's an increase over 5.1% sequester last year. We now have a budget agreement which reduces that sequester. We have an appropriations bill that was approved just yesterday, which gives indications to agencies to reduce that sequester. But there's no guidance. There's no guidance in either bill as to what that reduction will be, what programs will or will not be affected, what agencies will or will not be affected, what timeline those reductions, if any, will occur. As a result, on your profile.
Before we get into that, and you're talking about what they've done with that recent budget bill, and Representative Wallace sent me some information, they have not included any PILT funding. So what's the impact of that? I mean, you don't see it in our Craig, but certainly the counties will feel that. And isn't it like $25 million that we get per year for PILT, and now that is not in the budget? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Those are funds that are distributed directly to counties with federal lands. In some cases, that is a sizable portion of their budget. Washakie County, Bighorn County, for example. In other cases, particularly on the eastern side, it is a much more modest.
Do you have that number of how much money that is per year? Could you get that for us, please?
I could get the exact number. It is in the neighborhood of 25.
That's what I thought.
$25 million.
Okay. Continue.
So with respect to, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the sequester going forward, Craig elected not to include anything in here, but they did issue a statement of support to include it in the profile. Well, the argument for that is the profile changes once a week during the session, once a day, and it is a much more flexible document to respond to additional federal guidance. So if you will look at the three accounts that are affected, BRA, Budget Reserve Account, SFP, School Foundation Program, and School Capital Construction Program, you will see a specific line item. I'm looking on page 3 for the Budget Reserve Account. The third row down with numbers populated, we have profiled the federal sequester at 8%. We hope it's something less than that. We can change this number as soon as we get guidance from the Department of Interior that it is something different from that. We have also included the current tradition of the federal government, the current law, in our opinion, that those funds are restored. So we take them out in fiscal year 14, we put them back in 15. We take them out in 16, we put them back in 17. We go through the entire forecast doing that takeout, put in, takeout, put in. But the first year, we're going to have a takeout because it's not put in until the next year. That's why you see in 13-14 a negative $37.3 million. That's the don't get me wrong, the $37.3 million is put back in the next year, but a like amount is taken out. So it kind of gyrates throughout the forecast. We hope we can reduce that if we have any indication from the Department of Interior the sequester will be reduced or eliminated, we will respond in a timely fashion.
Okay, any questions on the sequester?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman and Don, going originally before the most recent appropriations and budget bill, what was there an additional ramping up of if, you know, we went from the whatever the 5.5 to the 8, was there an additional increase year over year going forward, or how was that originally contemplated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, there is a ramping up. We anticipated the increase from 5.1% to 8%, but candidly, I wasn't aware of what it would be. We were just expecting some increase. Going forward, I think it is very, very difficult to anticipate what will happen. There is a expectation that there will be additional sequesters in the absence of congressional action, but we have held it at 8%. You could make an argument that's not, and from my own personal opinion, it is very difficult to forecast some revenue components. We're really based on weather and world markets, but one of the most difficult things to project is congressional action, and that's what we're left with here.
Okay.
So,
continue.
Mr. Chairman, the key points now is what I want to kind of drive home here. We added 51.9. We take off a fair bit of sequester. The net-net, if you look at this compared to what we provided in October, is pretty modest, $11.1 million for the 15-16 and fiscal year 14 by fiscal years. $11.1 million on a $3.6 billion budget is a very, very modest change. We made a tweak here, is the bottom line. We shifted some timing. You will see in the legislative stabilization reserve account on page 3, the first column, we anticipated a deposit of $23.6 million given the governor's recommendations. That actually goes down to $14.9 million, so we lost a little bit of money in 13-14. But in 15-16, we gained about $19 million. And you will see that $19 million increase. Also on page 3, the total balance available under the budget reserve account, that's the first section on page 3, we increased from $328.6 million to $348.5 million. The key point here, and this will become a bit more automatic once JAC starts to mark up their bill, but we anticipate that you will set aside the statutory reserve amount. That is a statutory reserve amount of $109.86 million. So you will recall in the governor's rec October, that's the third column, the number actually, you can look on the his fiscal profile. He has $219 million. That's the amount of money that's left on the table. Now you have $238.6 million. And when we start marking up next week, that's the number we will measure everything to and against. So once you deposit money for savings to the water account, for example, let's say you take $30 million, that number drops. That number drops to 208.6. Let's say you increase money for Medicaid or DD waiver or something. Well, we're going to reduce that further. So everything comes off of the 238.6 at this point, whether it's put in savings or whether it's put in for additional spending or you make cuts. If you make cuts to the governor's budget, that number grows. I think that's the key point. And once you identify where you want money swept, or if you do, that total balance available in the budget reserve account will give a good indication of, okay, what's available for the floor, what's available for savings or new appropriations.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, the one critical thing, just 1 second, Senator Perkins, is the COLI's bonus money after 2017 is zero, and that hasn't changed. And so I want everybody to be sure to understand. Go ahead, Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Just a quick question. So when we look at the 218, or in this case now it's been adjusted to 238 with the new information, Mr. Chairman, my question would be, So when it says the governor's rec, does this mean that if we just took, if you took the budget bill or the governor's budget as it was, the standard budget plus take into account all of his recommendations, that's what the number is?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I do want to comment on two issues, because there is an issue of and a sensitivity about separation of powers. Just for practical purposes, we show the governor's rec column. I recognize that the judiciary is not in the governor's recommendation, but he did provide a placeholder for that. We include the same placeholder. We treat the feed bill, that is the legislature's appropriation, the same way. We do have a difference right off the bat. The governor's recommendation included $17.4 million for the legislature. Management Council has already met. Their appropriation bill is $19.2 million. So we have a difference there of $1.7 million roughly. We've included, I recognize that is not the governor's recommendation, but for practical purposes, we just simply can't have a column for each branch of government.
And Mr. Chairman,
okay. Go ahead, Representative.
What about the other additional expenditures that we're getting letters on from the governor? Are those incorporated into that or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, all of the items that are included in his profile for which he did not include in the budget, so, for example, $175 million for cities, towns, and counties, is not in his budget but is in his profile. We expect a governor's letter on that. $50 million for compensation. It is not in his budget. It is in his profile. We've included all of those items. What we have not included is, through the testimony over the past 4 or 5 weeks, issues may have come up, and he may have changed his mind to say, well, I really do want an additional $1 million for this fence project or that. We have not incorporated them. We will. We have not received those letters. So it's possible that we will have a new profile early next week that increases the governor's recommendation.
Do you have a rough estimate on how much that's going to be?
What was that?
Do you have a rough estimate on how much that is going to be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I defer that to the budget office. I have no idea.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. So the placeholder for judiciary is on the profile. Is it the standard budget? That was submitted by judiciary? Is that how that works?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it is the standard budget plus all exception requests.
So, Mr. Chairman, it'd be the total agency request column. That's the placeholder.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And again, it gets into the weeds a little bit. There's a slight difference between the governor's profile and the judiciary. The governor did not include the exception request for the district courts, but I've been told that's entirely an oversight. He didn't, you know. We have included everything that they've asked for. So if you, say, reduce some of their computer expenses, that would add to the bottom line. It's already included in there, and it leaves $238 million on the table.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Senator Meyer.
Don, it just seems like to me the degree of certainty or those things that are kind of out there, that the degree of certainty or the things that are out there were, you know, we compared to where it was 2, 4, 6 years ago, there's a lot more moving parts. And I think that you mentioned that the actions that happen in Washington can have a, you know, impact on this. It's really hard to profile those, hard to profile weather. We're usually fairly conservative, but as Chairman Bebout remarked that in a couple of years we're, you know, even though we never profile Coley's bonuses, we had a pretty good idea, you know, that they were coming. Now we've got a pretty good idea that, well, maybe if they are coming, they're going to be a lot less than they ever have been before. So I'm just wondering about your senses as to whether or not we can spend down like we have in previous years down to that line and then expect not to be digging a hole 2, 3, 4 years out. And, you know, I guess I'm looking for that your comfort feeling and the degree of certainty And I know that you guys do your job and you're very analytical on it, but, you know, this preparation of Craig versus the preparations of previous Craigs, and to me, I'm uneasy about spending as much money as what we used to, because we used to get it down to with, and, you know, you don't have very much left at all. I can remember the 90s, you know, there wasn't much at all left at the end of the day. I just don't know whether we can do that anymore.
Go ahead, Don.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, and I'd be happy to have Mr. Noble offer his comments on this. I wanted to dominate the conversation about the profile because that's our product, so I didn't mean to dismiss his views on that. I think it's always a challenging environment. We have had disruptions in world markets that reduced the price of oil from $148 a barrel down to the $30 per barrel within a matter of months. There have been weather events such as the winter of 2012, which had a significant negative impact on the price and production levels of natural gas. It's never an easy guess, if you will, or forecast for these. I think there are a number of concerns out there on the horizon. Regulations of coal is probably top among them in my mind. The competition of other supplies of natural gas and what that will do to Wyoming is another big issue. But we also have some positives to look forward to as well. I'm very hopeful and impressed about the increased oil production. You know, we've had about 3 years now after 20-some years of declining oil production where we have bottomed out and now are rising. So we're turning the corner there, and it shows up not only in production numbers but in sales tax numbers and elsewhere. I think we have we don't try to hide anything, and there are opportunities for gains in investments that are not included in our profile. These are opportunities to the upside, which could cushion risks to the downside. It's difficult for me to, you know, come out there and say, hey, what's the number that you'd like to have carried over? Well, for me to sleep at night, I like a big number, but I understand there's a risk of doing that, doing too much to that as well, because these are, you know, tax rates that the citizens of Wyoming are paying through property and sales tax and others, and so there's a balance there. I really don't think it's for me to say, other than there, the policymakers may want to consider having funds available for a supplemental session. What that number is not my call.
Did you say supplemental? We don't want to talk about supplemental budgets right now.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Go ahead.
And I mean that in the strict terms of emergency activities, because emergencies happen every year. We have natural disasters of floods, which impact communities and highway systems, and we have forest fires, and those things have to get paid for, and we have edicts from the federal government or those sorts of things. So I'm not talking about, you know, growth. I'm talking about real emergencies and having a security to respond to those.
Okay, anything else? Mr. Chairman.
Don, just a question, you know, just an observation. I guess I'd like your comment on this. Just over the last several years, maybe the last decade really, where this profile is, there's what I see is really a shift. It's more of a balancing where you've seen sales and use tax kind of take on a greater role, and particularly investment income take on a bigger role, and the mineral piece shrink a little bit. Can you comment on that, this historical perspective?
Don?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I would agree. And if you look back at the Tax Reform 2000, you know, there were discussions of a more balanced revenue approach. Wyoming is getting a little bit more balanced, and a lot of that has to do with the investment side of the portfolio and equity gains and activities that are, you know, Wyoming or certain communities might be in a decline, and parts of the national economy may be on the upswing, and the investment in other entities allows Wyoming to capture some of those gains. I think there's also been somewhat of a balancing among the commodities. So right. we have seen a decline in natural gas and an increase in oil. And it's not going to work out quite this way, but we used to be like 80-20. You know, gas was king. And now we're closer. We're not there yet, but we're closer to a third, a third, a third. A third oil, a third gas, and a third coal. And when you don't have, you know, one commodity that is completely overshadowing the production of other commodities, and even smaller activities, sales tax, is really evident where we're seeing increase, but we're not seeing increases in every county. We're seeing real declines in some part of the state, Sublette County, Sweetwater County, Sheridan County last year. But that's being overwhelmed by Casper and Laramie and Jackson. So you're seeing a diversity in the geography as well. Some parts of the state are doing dramatically better than other parts of the state.
What about, and I guess the investment piece, you know, the investment income and you know, we had a plan, it's been years back, to double the permanent mineral trust fund, you know, and it's now, and I think Senator Perkins said it a year ago or so, when, you know, compound interest is a horrible thing when it's working against you, and it's a beautiful thing when it's working for you. And you know, just looking at our projections, we're really set without really any disruption on our part, just to continue our policies to really double it again to that, instead of 4 by 10, really to almost an 8 billion part by 2018 as I look at the projections. And so that'll continue to grow. And I guess that's an editorial piece, but is that the projection that we're close to if we follow our policies, about 8 billion in 2018?
Mr. Co-Chairman.
Speaking of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund now.
Yes. I think that the state has enjoyed tremendous gains from the investments in those savings accounts. We're at $6.5 billion market value in our PMTF, $6 billion on a cost basis, which means we've got $500 million in unrealized capital gains if we were to, you know, liquidate today,
right,
or in the near term. We're well on our way to 8 by 18. The growth in our investment side of our portfolio has benefited by additional savings, not only to the PMTF, but we're sitting on $1.6 billion in the LSRA that's working. Now, the downside, a positive and a negative. The positive is, in the near term, 18, 24, 36 months, we've seen pretty extraordinary gains in the equity markets, perhaps unlikely,
sure,
to continue at that rate, at least. Not saying that they won't some time in the future, but it'll be difficult to match those returns. On the fixed side, we're seeing extremely low interest rates, and that's kind of a double-edged sword. The bonds that we hold may be underwater, but if interest rates rise to 3, 4%, 5%, that makes a huge difference on all of that cash that we have, because our LSRA is really in short term.
Sure.
And it would generate even more funds for the operation of state government.
So part of the story really has to be the work that we started 10 years ago or better. It's saving our budget right now, investment income. It's a huge part. It's growing, and we'll continue to get bigger. And I think part of the challenge with us was spending is to keep that investment income. A lot of us have had that goal, getting it back to that 20% expenditure level that it used to years and years ago. And as we increased expenditures, of course, the percentage of the PMTF became quite small, and we're starting to kind of gain ground on that again, which is a good sign. And we do that a couple ways. Obviously, savings and investment growth, but really expenditure growth as well. So, okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's a key part about that, is we've grown government so much in terms of overall spending that the permanent mineral trust fund revenues aren't as big a percentage as they used to be. And when we had the difficult times in the 80s and 90s, it was running 23 and 24%. I think recently it's down to maybe 15 or 16%. I totally agree with you. The way you build that up is to build the corpus, and then the corpus generates the revenues. And the other side of that is to control the growth of government. It goes hand in hand. I agree totally. Senator Perkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, one of the things I was just observing, I want to see if I'm looking at this right. when we look at if you look at Table 2 in the Craig, which is the general fund revenues minus collections by source, when we look at that, I mean, just this kind of, if I'm reading this right, it kind of bears out, I think, what Co-Chairman Harshman was saying, that when you look at the big four here on expenses are severance tax, sales and use tax, permanent trust fund income, pooled income, and you look at those, and when you know, the last few years, that the permanent trust fund income, when you include the capital gains, has actually been the second largest source of revenue to the general fund. I mean, am I reading that right?
Don? Mr. Chairman, Senator, you're exactly correct. And you can see in total, we've had a pretty big increase in the budget. If you look back 10 years or so, we've doubled it. And you can see the first spike, 07-08, that's largely due to minerals as well as PMTF. But then if you look at 11 and 12, that's largely due to the PMTF and the capital gains there.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, if I can ask another question, and so I mean, so when we have capital gains, the PMTF, the Permanent Trust Fund, actually looks, you know, it actually is trending towards becoming the second largest source of general fund revenues. But when you have a down year, for example, if you go back and look on Table 2 again in 2009, 2010, when we had a $1 billion of unrealized of losses, when you combine the unrealized and the actual realized, we end up with $1 billion of losses in the permanent trust fund. Then there is actual volatility with respect to capital gains, and that's the continued philosophy. So when you look at 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, look at the income of the permanent trust fund. That's why the Craig continues to not include them. The Treasurer's Office does not include or forecast capital gains. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Originally, just for some history here, we used to have that permanent mineral trust fund reserve account with a flow both in and out, in which case it smoothed the spikes. Well, now the flow is one directional. In a year of losses, there is no help from that account to support the general fund and its expenditures. So I think that's why Craig, or a component of why Craig is a little bit more conservative on the capital gains, is because there's no guarantee of a safety net in a down year. The legislature, I think, has responded to that policy by segregating a portion of those capital gains into an account for future expenditures, the SIPA in this case. All that really did was delay the expenditure of those funds 1 year and identify them as one-time projects. It's two different approaches, but it essentially achieves a similar outcome. And it avoids a lot of the volatility if you do have a down year and you've spent those funds. Last point I'll make on that question is it's important to recognize next week, you will be appropriating funds for which we are projecting revenues in the first 6 months of 2016. 2 years from now, you are not appropriating money that you have in cash. You're appropriating projected revenues.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
And two other things that just to follow on, just to make sure that I'm trying to make sure I learn a little bit more every year about this, but back to that one issue, which is really kind of a timing issue with respect to capital gains. The very reason you talk about that, I mean, when we have in select Committee on Capital Finance and Investments, we refer to it as the Meyer Rule, which is how the Treasurer's Office, if I understand it right, Treasurer's Office captures capital losses, and instead of requiring that those, because the permanent trust fund is inviolate, those funds, we have to protect that principal. But he holds those losses in kind of in a reserve, and then as the market comes back and we have additional capital gains, he allocates that and captures some of the capital gains to offset the capital losses that he holds in, instead of requiring that they be repaid in the year as soon as possible, which in some cases if you went back to 2007, 2008, there would have been no income out of the permanent trust fund without the Meyer rule. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct. I'm not sure if I would say no income. It would be very, very small, if anything, if you used all interest and dividends to compensate for capital losses. Basically, what the Meyer rule does is say you're still going to get your interest and dividends, and Craig has said that's what we're projecting. And we were fortunate, I think, as a state, that we restored those losses through gains in about the next 2 years, a little less than 2 years. But that didn't have to be the case. We could have held those losses for 4 or 5 plus years, you know, depending on how deep they were and how quick the national economy rebounded. So that's another reason, and Craig is not uniform in their opinions on this matter. We have a number of discussions about which direction should we go, and at this time we're, for the reason exactly that you're describing, we're, as a group, reluctant to include gains when those gains may not be realized.
Mr. Chairman, I'll beat this horse. I got one
go
more
ahead.
Question that hit this dead horse one more time. But the and so when we talk about, a lot of that has to do with timing. Timing is everything on these capital gains. And so what we've got about $100-odd million of capital gains that we recognized out of the pooled income for the common agency fund. That we have that reflected in the profile here, if I remember right, there's roughly that. But we did that recognizing that we were going to take capital gains on because we were anticipating higher interest rates, and most of that's in fixed income. So when interest rates go up, the value of fixed income goes down typically. And so recognizing that, the Treasurer's Office sold those out. We took about $100-odd million of capital gains out of the pooled agency fund, anticipating that we're going to have capital losses when interest rates go up. And so we've got about $100 million of capital gains profiled in Craig that we know that we're potentially spending, depending on what we do. But we know that there's going to be capital losses coming in the next year or two out of the pooled agency fund, and there's no – is the Meyer rule apply to the common pool fund as well as the permanent mineral trust fund?
Turn your mic on. Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, yes, the Meyer rule, and we clarified that, applies across all funds. And you're correct, it is a timing issue. I think it was $136 million of general funds from 2013. They were realized, the fiscal year ended, they were included on Craig as actual cash received because that's our policy. Well, after June 2013, we now have losses. We don't offset losses against previous gains. We only offset losses against future gains. So we're essentially now in a holding pattern for when the next gains will accrue. And in an increasing interest rate environment on a fixed income only portfolio, we could be waiting a while.
Yeah, and the other thing we need to be thinking about too, and Mr. Co-Chairman, I've talked about it, is, and it's all timing, but reflecting the current conditions of the marketplace, we wish we'd have had the pooled accounts could have been invested in securities rather than in fixed, because if this thing turns around, we're going to, and there's no choice. I mean, that's what the statute says, but we're going to take some real hits there. Senator Meyer.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and you know, I think that rule that Treasurer Meyer put forth was at a time period where the budget was tight. We hadn't really prepared for a significant capital losses. But, folks, I got to tell you, to me, it just seems like we're not meeting the spirit of the Constitution as far as holding our corpuses inviolate. That there, and I know we had talked about that in our spending policy reserve, and essentially what we wanted to do was front load for any capital losses, and so when they occurred, we could take them out of a holding account instead of just betting that the next roll of the dice over the next few years was going to come up in our favor. And to me, I just have a little bit of heartburn if we continue to go down this road
I think at some point in time we have to, you know, call it for what it is, that we are just gambling on a future possible profit, where if we get to in a situation where we actually have some extra money, we have some capital gains, that we should put that in a spending policy reserve account that we can pull out of when the capital losses occur. And this year is a perfect year. We took our capital gains on our bond portfolio, and now we already are exhibiting capital losses. But we're just going to forget about those and book them in this imaginary account, into hoping that at some point in time we'll have a capital gain. The capital gains are already in hand. And so we're going to book a negative number against our corpus. I don't think that's what our constitutional amendment said. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it was out of the capital losses were essentially against our corpus from my perspective, that if you have a capital loss, it's a capital loss. And segregating the different classes of revenue from your bond portfolio and all other revenue sources, that they're both in the corpus. You don't have a corpus just for bonds and a corpus just for stocks.
Okay, those are good comments, Senator Meyer. Thank you. We're going to move on. The last thing that you didn't mention, and this will be the last thing we talk about, is in the school foundation program. You know, we took a hit of around $20 million. The way I read it, in terms of revenues available, and this only reflects the state portion. It doesn't reflect the side of the from the that you do in the local mill levies. So, how much is the hit to the foundation program,
Mr. Chairman? This actually does incorporate the hit, if you will, to the ad valorem taxes at the local level, because the way the model works is we have a guaranteed payment, no matter how much is generated at the local level. But you're exactly right that we have a reduction net of $25 million. A lot of that has to do, in 15-16, a lot of that has to do with the sequester, which is noted on the lines for both the SFP and the school capital construction account. You will also see that we have projected increased expenditures. You can see $1.48 to $1.49 billion on the school foundation program appropriation for the including the ECA as recommended by the governor and this committee. So that is primarily due to enrollment increases. We have final data, if you will, for the session, and our enrollment is rising modestly, and perhaps more importantly, from what I understand, it's rising in the areas with the highest costs, you know, the districts that benefit from a regional cost adjustment and those sorts of things.
Really? Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask a question, Don, on that? I just want to make sure I'm clear on the October Craig to the January Craig on the first line of appropriations on school foundation program, including external cost adjustment, where it went from 1.479 to 1.489. Do both those numbers include the external cost adjustment? And that $10 million growth, as I understand it, is student growth. So both of them include the external cost adjustment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I think Matt may want to.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And, you know, the enrollment grew about 0.34% more than we had in projected, so it was a 1.34% growth over last school year to this school year.
And we're just the top growth districts, real quick. Just
Mr. Chairman, here in Laramie County School District Number 1, it was 400 students. I think Teton County School District Number 1 was another 100 students. Sweetwater was a couple hundred students. Sweetwater 1.
Yeah.
Natrona was only about 50 students.
Yeah. Big growth a year ago.
Yeah.
Slowed down a little bit.
And Mr. Chairman, like Don said, these estimates take into account the local assessed valuation changes, and so that's why you see a decrease in the revenue, because the recapture will decrease, but you also see the increase in entitlement payments as well.
And that's primarily sequester, primarily.
Mr. Chairman, no. The sequester
that's not on the local part,
that's not
of
local
course.
Level.
That's on this side.
Mr. Chairman, just to regarding the external cost adjustment, remember the supplies, materials, and the energy were preliminary at our November meeting that we discussed that at. And we finalized those estimates in this profile, and that increase from a $38.5 million biennial cost for fiscal year 15's ECA to $39.5 million, so just about $1 million difference.
Yeah, Matt, give us a number of the total increase that we're spending in the foundation program with the enrollment and the ECA and everything when you get a chance, if you would, please. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We're ready for Department of Transportation. We'll do a two-minute Senate stretch. Okay, are we live? Okay. Department of Transportation, John, welcome. It's good to have you here today with the Joint Appropriations Committee. What we'd like to do is have you give an overview of your department, what's going on, anything you see that's critical to the job you have and the mission you have and what you do for the state of Wyoming. And then after we've done that, and we may ask questions as we go through it, sort of an executive report, if you will, then we want to get through the budget, get into the budget, and we'll go through it page by page. So with that, you know the drill. Identify yourself, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to talk about the budget, the legislative budget for the biennium that YDOT has proposed and the governor has recommended. Mr. Chairman, the significant requests that are represented in the biennial budget that we'll go through this morning are associated with economic development on the one hand, and on infrastructure maintenance on the other hand. Specifically, air service enhancement is an economic development issue that has been ongoing in the state, and we'll be talking about that and prepared to discuss that in whatever detail that you would like. Roads and obviously associated safety, and then Wild Link in terms of infrastructure maintenance. Mr. Chairman, you won't hear us request anything that will be a deviation from the governor's recs, but we will do everything we can to answer any and all questions that you might have. Let me first start by introducing the people that I have with me today. I think they're familiar to most of you, but I'll just go ahead and really quick run down the list and have them lift a hand as I go through. Everybody knows Kevin, right? And Kevin Hibbert is our budget officer for the Department of Transportation, has been for quite some time. And he's kind of the answer man when it comes to all things budget. On the engineering and highways and operations side, we have three of our we have our chief engineer and two assistant chiefs engineer, Del McComey, Greg Frederick, and Ken Schultz. Greg is in charge of all things engineering, I guess you could say, I'm not including the districts, but everything planning and design and engineering at the headquarters level, in addition to some other stuff. And then Ken oversees operations. Two key agencies that are represented by executive staff here this morning, Dennis Byrne, our aeronautics administrator, is here, and Colonel John Butler and Lieutenant Colonel Shannon Ratliff are here from the Wyoming Highway Patrol. And then finally, last but not least, because I think you hear from him as much as you do from anybody else, is a guy that that represents not only a couple of key sub-agencies within the Department of Transportation, but also our virtually our whole support services branch, and that's Tom Lofton. Oh, finally, last but not least, is Sandy Scott, our Transportation Commission Secretary, and also our legislative coordinator. She's her job when not concerned with commission business is kind of herding the cats with regards to stateside legislative issues. We also have the pleasure of having the chairman of our Aeronautics Commission, Charlie Kassir from Laramie, is here with us today. Did I get everybody? You'd think that we just kind of came in and filled up the room. But
some people have said that you have a large department, John.
Mr. Chairman, we on a Wyoming scale, we're huge. But I will hasten to add that on a national scale, we're one of the smallest departments of transportation in the country.
I had to let you say that as well. I knew that you would come back with that one. It's too bad that live Wyoming can't see that smile on his face,
that's,
right?
Incidentally, that's something I brag about at the national level, too. I think I've mentioned this to you folks before, but Wyoming and Wisconsin are the only two departments of transportation that also include the State Highway Patrol. Left. I think it used to be a little bit more than norm, but because it fits on a Wyoming scale and because it works, that was done in 1991 during government reorganization, and as well, YDOT is the only agency that includes not only that, but also everything that would be the DMV in most other states. And so not only on a kind of an economy of scale sort of thing does that work, but it also works in Wyoming. We are able to do things communicatively and cooperatively in Wyoming that other states wish they could do because they're trying to negotiate with other state agencies or whatever. And particularly when you have the state uniform law enforcement agency and driver services and all things regarding the transportation system under one roof and at one table. I can tell you from hearing personally from colleagues around the country that that's something that they wish they could do. I'm not sure they want to oversee the guys with the uniforms, but Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do, let me first just tell you the kind of the six main components. So this is taking something that right out of the budget document that's in front of you. But then I want to go into just a couple of minutes to give you a federal funds update, which is, as you know, the update that I'm going to give you is as recent as yesterday afternoon. But I know we're probably going to be backing up just a little bit in this document once I hand this off to Kevin. But if you look at page 6 at the bottom of the page, it shows kind of the main primary functions of the Department of Transportation. Those are construction, maintenance, obviously, of the highways, law enforcement, obviously, that's the Wyoming Highway Patrol, administration and regulatory functions, and aeronautics. And then there's details under with each one of those subcategories. But in Governor Sullivan's reorganization in 91, there was a really significant putting together of a bunch of components of Wyoming state government that put all of this in one agency. Mr. Chairman, with regard to just a quick and dirty federal funds update, telling you something that you probably already know, but the in Congress, the House and the Senate both have passed an appropriations bill for the remainder of this federal fiscal year, thus avoiding another shutdown of any kind. And we anticipated that there would be extensions, but what they've done is they've passed a bill and sent it on to the president for signature. I don't know if he's actually signed the bill or not, but we're hoping that he has. We think he may have, which funds the federal government for the rest of this fiscal year through September 30th. In highway terms, in terms of highway funds and the federal funds that WIDOT uses, here what that means is a continuation of the same funding as we've been using, as we've had access to for the remainder of this fiscal year. It does not interact with the future in terms, and I would tell you that MAP 21, which is the current transportation bill that we're working under federal funds wise, expires at the end on the same date as the current budget does. And at this point, the momentum is building toward crafting another bill, but it's very slow in building. The MAP 21 was intended to be a template for future bills, which should theoretically make it easier for the next federal transportation bill. We'll see how that works, because there always can be tweaks that are interjected at the congressional level during the crafting of another bill. But what we're hoping for, and what we're really hoping on our bucket list, is to see a new transportation bill by September 30th. If that happens, it'll be the first time in a long time. Last year was several years late. The previous one to that was a couple of years late.
So, John, on that mm-hmm. the federal bill that included the funding for transportation, was that the one that included the AML language as well? Was that the one where that happened? I think it probably was, but I...
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Hibbert, Budget Officer of the Department of Transportation, if you could specify which AML pot that you're speaking
to. What I thought there was a federal transportation bill that the Congress passed, and that's where, in the dead of night, they added the amendment that eliminated our AML funds that rightfully ours. I think it was the same bill. It's not important whether it was or wasn't, but I just was curious.
Yes, that is correct. I believe what took place was that they did put a rider on that transportation bill that took a substantial amount of AML money from the state of Wyoming.
Okay, continue.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, the senator who we've considered a friend in the transportation business for many years, but whom we also blame for that, is going to be the ambassador to China. So I don't know if that helps you feel better about any of that or not.
Everybody has their opinion on that one, too.
Okay. Let's see. Get back to my notes here so I don't get ahead of myself. Highway Trust Fund, which funds the highway funds that we get through the Fed. I'm going to read you just one line from an email that we got from D.C. yesterday, and I'm just going to read this verbatim. What we have known, and I think what we've tried to convey to you folks here on the committee, is that the Highway Trust Fund balance is projected to go into a negative balance during the federal fiscal year of 2015. Let me read this statement. USDOT estimates announced this week increasingly question whether the HTF, the Highway Trust Fund, will make it through fiscal year 2014 with a 2014 with a positive balance. This will be a very close call. This is from someone that represents Wyoming and four other very rural states, our contiguous states to us, and it's a pretty authoritative source. But really all that means at this point is that there's an awareness. USDOT is aware that the inflows are going to bring that balance down to close to nothing. They knew that when they passed MAP 21. They knew that that was going to be probably the lion's share of the work is going to be figuring out where the funding is going to come from for any future transportation bill. It's been propped up for some time by general fund infusions and some other fiscal measures, but it is your guess is as good as mine how they will decide to fund the next transportation bill, and I would tell you that is probably going to have a large interaction with how quickly the thing moves forward. I think the template, the skeletal portions of that, you know, probably at the 80 percentile or 90 percentile are done, but the fiscal considerations are daunting back there.
Yeah, and that most of that money comes from the federal gasoline tax, and I think that's at 23, 25 cents a gallon, whatever it is, and that's something that's has been that way for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
The question I would have is your level funding that you talked about, what is that amount?
Mr. Chairman, on the service transportation side from FHWA, it's about $223 million a year.
Continue. Any questions, committee? Okay.
With regard to MAP 21 and the reauthorization of that into whatever the next highway bill is going to be represented by acronym, I'm not going to make any predictions other than I'll just be surprised if they get that ready to go on time. Like I said, the fiscal support is going to be the big question. Without predicting anything at this point at all, and there's no agenda here on my part other than to give you the update as I know it. I will tell you this, that today, and this is thanks to the passage of the increase in the Wyoming fuel tax this past session. Today, our dependence upon federal funds for highway construction and maintenance is ratioed at about 65% federal funds and about 35% state funds. So if the Highway Trust Fund gets into deep trouble and something isn't done, we can see a reduction in a very swift manner to about 60% of that federal funding on the highway side that we're accustomed to. I'm not using that as a springboard to ask you for any money. I just want you to know that our historical dependence on federal funds still remains. We've, incidentally, thanks to the action taken by the legislative body last year, it took us from a ratio of about 80% federal funded on the highway construction side to and 20% state. So it did make a significant difference, for which we are really appreciative, and particularly given the fact that the fuel tax constitutes a predictable stream of funding for us. So thanks again for that. I believe that the awareness of the need for taking care of the transportation infrastructure, the awareness in Congress is pretty much loud and clear. Earlier this week, Monday through Wednesday, I was in D.C., and participated in a roundtable discussion where I was allowed. I represented Wyoming. There was a representative from the Arkansas Department of Transportation, my counterpart, and also my counterpart from the Virginia DOT. And each of us was asked to kind of tell the story of the state-side initiatives that have been taken to increase transportation funding in our respective states. Virginia has just passed this mind-boggling, huge issue there that I'm still trying to get my head around, but it was a neat opportunity to tell a story of how it played out in Wyoming and the benefit to Wyoming's highways. I think that the awareness going back to the Congress of the need for the continued care of the transportation infrastructure is clear. And in that roundtable, I said, you know, the Wyoming attitude, I think, and I said, I can't speak for my legislature, and I don't want to speak for all my surrounding rural state colleagues, but I will tell you that I think that my sense is, as an observer and as a participant, is that the national highway system, in particular the interstate highway system, is a national responsibility. And any notion of the federal government just simply backing away from that and telling the states, well, now it's yours to take care of with stateside funding, I would not be greeted with in Wyoming with any great welcome. I did tell them that the fuel tax in Wyoming is being spent for contractor payouts, road construction only. It's not being used for administrative costs. I did tell them that it's not being used on the interstate, which is an indication of where our priorities lie with that particular funding initiative. I had last thing I would just tell you that in this update is that I had then the opportunity on Wednesday morning to meet with Senator Barrasso. Good, productive conversation, and really, in a sense, kind of covered the very same topics, where we are in Wyoming. And by the way, he asked me to tell you guys hi and send his greetings. And he expressed his admiration at you guys. I'm quoting him, okay? So I'm just a message guy. But he said, I really admire those guys for pulling this thing off. He was talking about the fuel tax. I think he's well aware. He's a member of the EPW, the Environment and Public Works Committee. Critical assignment for the senator, simply because they're the kind of the committee of jurisdiction for the next highway bill on the Senate side. And not only is that a significant voice on the committee who's very rural conscious, but it also is one that is very aware of what our issues are in terms of protecting Wyoming's interests as a new bill is crafted. And that, I don't know that I could underestimate that, simply because when I go to these meetings, the national level meetings, it readily becomes apparent that there is not necessarily competition, but there are certainly different schools of thought that tie themselves to metropolitan areas and metropolitan issues versus rural bridge states. And so that opportunity on the roundtable, that opportunity of speaking with the senator are times that I really appreciate, and the opportunity to kind of tell the Wyoming story is one that I think we need. Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions about this topic or anything else that you want to talk to me about at this point, I think what I would suggest we do is just turn it over to Kevin, and he'll take you program by program through the budget.
Yeah, the only thing I had is, could you provide us what the national average is relative to feds versus what the states provide, and then do a regional one for us? Just get that to us. I'd be curious about that.
Yes, sir. Just in terms of soundbite, we'll get you the actual information, but just in terms of soundbite, the national average has hovered at about 60% state and 40% federal for quite some time.
Okay,
so
thank you.
We're
any
just
other,
upside down from that.
Any other questions of John at this time, committee? Okay, let's do the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Hibbard, Budget Officer of the Department of Transportation. Is the request for the national averages and what states getting how much federal funds has been provided to you at the commission discussion that we had. I know we gave you lots of materials, but perhaps Don Richards could help you ferret that particular table out. It's in that presentation. If not, I'd be happy to point that out to you. But those are the materials that we provided you in our commission discussion.
This is like a quiz, how much we read of all this data we get. And I'm sure most of us read that. It might have just slipped our minds. And speaking of the chairman only, I'm sure members of this committee know those numbers. Okay, let's go ahead and go on to budget.
Well, the other choice I had, Mr. Chairman, was to get it to you within like 3 minutes and make you look like I really was on the ball. But we put that information together for you. I'd like to start by kind of working from the commission budget discussion that we had previous to the legislative budget, because the last thing we talked about is we ended our conversation about the commission budget, about what the appropriation process was and the funding and the expenses for the Transportation Commission, and then we ended that conversation knowing that we'd come in and talk about the legislative budget. Our conversation with commission budget all was on a fiscal year, one single year, and now we're going to shift into a biennium discussion. So I'm going to try to relate the commission side of the budget on a biennium basis real quick, and then walk into the legislative appropriation budget. But if you go to page 4 of our budget request, you'll see that there's a request that's made and recommended by the governor of $264,033,857. That's what our budget request has been recommended by the governor. That is the legislative side of the budget. In biennium-based terms, if you look at the commission side of the budget, it's $1 billion. $85 million. So you're looking at about $1.2, $1.3 billion on a biennium basis for the Department of Transportation's budget in its entirety. You'll see on the bottom of page 4 that there's 563 positions on the legislative side of the budget. And we provided you the detail of the whole organization's positions in our last conversation, but I'm going to recap that real quick. YDOT has 2,058 positions, and those positions are controlled by administration and information, HR, just like all other organizations. All the pays is subject to the same Hays study rules as all the other organizations. 563 positions being on the legislative side, 1,495 positions being on the commission side of the budget. As of this recommendation, because there is one position transfer in here that we'll talk about later, just taking a step back a few years, if you go to 2010, we had 2,201 positions. So that means that today, the Department of Transportation, to that of 2010, we have reduced our positions by 143 positions. But in all fairness, we transferred 22 positions over to ETS, of which 22 full-time positions were transferred over to ETS. However, if you'll look at the documentation that we provided to you, there were some other positions. There was some AWACS, and there's a dispatch position that was transferred as well. But the actual full-time positions that were transferred to ETS was 22. The total number of positions that were transferred to ETS was 27. So in math, that means that since 2010, we have cut 143 positions, 22 of them being a transfer, and we'll talk about that in detail as we go through the budget. And that remains like Department of Transportation has cut 121 positions since 2010. So that's a very brief oversight.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hibbert, just in looking at your base budget compared to your standard budget, there's two additional employees found in your standard budget. And can you tell us where those are? And maybe you can show us as we go through, but if you have an idea right now, too.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I will show you where those are in our budget conversation. One of those positions was a position that we had a need in Capital Protective Services, and we moved it from the Transportation Commission side over to Capital Protective Services. That was done through a B-11 approved by the governors, and we're following that up in the appropriations document. And that's the position that you see on page 4. The second position, you'll have to help me out because you're saying that you see two.
Mr. Chairman, if you look at full-time employees from your base budget, 557, standard budget, 559. I don't know where those two positions
are. Yes, I do know those positions. In fact, they're on our detail sheet that we provided you when we had a conversation earlier. That was two Transportation Commission positions that were transferred in for dispatching at the request of the last biennium discussion.
Senator Meyer.
I wanted to get a clarification on your terminology. When you say there's 563 legislatively assigned positions, are those all general funded positions, or are they a combination of general and federal funds? And when you say legislatively designated, a little fleshing that terminology out, please.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
The Department of Transportation has one legislatively, or excuse me, generally funded position, and that position happens to be sitting back right behind me, and that is our Air Service Enhancements Administrator. One generally funded position. The rest of the positions in the Department of Transportation are a combination of federal funds, commission dollars, state highway funds, et cetera, but there's only one position that's funded with general funds. The 563 positions are those positions that are appropriated by the legislature in the legislature legislative budget. The remainder of the positions reside on the commission side of the 1,495. So YDOT as an organization has a total of 2,058 positions, 563 being legislatively appropriated, 1,495 residing in the commission budget.
Mr. Chairman, and follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at some point in time, I know we're going to have a discussion about how you're funding any pay raises and what those might be. probably wouldn't be appropriate to go into it now, but
Mr. Chairman, I can give you a history of that real quick if you'd like me to.
Well, you want it,
Kurt?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, specifically, I'm trying to figure out how many general funds, or are you going to use federal funds, or are you going to fund it through attrition, or are you going to fund it through vacant positions, or are you going to? Is there a specific request for general funding for any pay raises, or are you guys just going to take care of it yourselves? And those type of things, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, historically, the Department of Transportation, when there is a across-the-board statewide salary increase that's offered to employees of state government, the Department of Transportation funds those through Department of Transportation highway funds. So we expect, you know, that trend, that's the historical trend. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't accept any other funding sources for those, but the trend happens to be that we'd fund those out of the Department of Transportation Commission side of the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Anything else? Continue.
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, if you kind of get a grasp of the total budget process, we'll lead into the legislative side, and we'll go into the units, and I'll go page by page. If you start on page 101, excuse me, page 16, that was a wish that I was on page 101. Is there any questions? Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the page 16 is the director's office, and there is a exception request, and what I'll do is there's a repeated reception request in here, and I'll address them one time, and then I'll refer to them as being repeated later on. And this particular example is the exception request on page 16 that starts on the bottom, a priority number 24, reduction in budget authority. You'll see that there's actually two on the following page 17. There's $1,000 that we're reducing the budget by, and also $6,048. And I apologize, because this particular request is repeated throughout the budget, and it's referring to the transfer of funds from the Department of Transportation Commission's budget. But actually, there's two elements here. The $1,000 is a wide-out budget cut in the professional services fees that we looked into, that we're not using that money, so that $1,000 is offered for a cut. It's not associated with the ETS transfer. The $6,048 is associated with the ETS transfer. We talked about the 22 full-time positions, the 27 in total positions that were transferred over to ETS, and this is what's taken place. Prior to the ETS movement, the Department of Transportation cleared our IT costs associated with the number of computers that a program had and the total number of computers of the organization, so that we could represent the total cost of each particular program inside of the organization. And that has historically been residing in each unit in the legislative appropriated budget, and also on the commission side as well. So when the ETS transfer took place, we reduced the appropriated budgets in each program by the amount of money that we're moving over to ETS, and that's going to be consolidated in later in the budget in 0400-0407 unit. Now, that particular ETS transfer was at the direction of the legislature, and we're just following up with cleaning up the house cleaning of the funding to trail into what the legislature has asked us to do. That is going to repeat itself in every one of our budgets. And when I get to that, I'll just say ETS transfer. And also, I will delineate where there's a budget cut from the Department of Transportation in these as well. So for the director, you'll see a $1,000 wide-out budget cut in professional services. And you'll also see an ETS transfer of $6,048. And quickly, throughout the budget, we're offering up $310,000 worth of budget cuts in this biennium by wide-out. And last biennium, we offered up $1 million worth of budget cuts, because we're looking at our budgets, we're trying to get more efficient, and we're trying to really get very concise with how much money that we really need to operate our programs. So
you said that last year you had $1 million worth of budget cuts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Last biennium, we cut $1 million. We brought a budget in front of you, and throughout all the legislative appropriated budgets, we reduced the standard budgets by $1 million.
Well, your 8% reduction was $2,063,000. Why are you and I disagreeing?
Mr. Chairman, your statistics are correct. I'm just simply talking about what YDOT cut, not the standard budget cuts that were offered. This is just our reviewing our standard budgets and taking the highway fund portion off.
You're talking about the commission side was a million. Is that what you're saying?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm talking about our legislative side of the budget. The highway funds side, the money that we use out of highway funds, we reduced our legislative appropriations budgets by $1 million. That did not include the general fund budget cuts that we discussed.
Okay, that's the $2 million I'm talking about.
That's exactly right.
So you had an additional $1 million, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's not profiled because we wouldn't see that here.
That's correct.
Right. Got it. Go ahead.
Okay, so that sums up the director's unit. If you go to page 19, you'll see that we have a budget request for legal services of $12,635. We do have a small budget for legal services. This is for our AG's office. We used to have the AG's office's budget inside of the Department of Transportation's budget in its entirety, but we moved that over to the AG's agency several years ago. But we do keep a little bit of money there because sometimes it's a requirement that our attorney generals that represent the Department of Transportation travel to other states or to meetings that are in particular interest of the Department of Transportation. For example, our AGs traveled to, I believe it was Oklahoma, to represent the state of Wyoming in a bankruptcy hearing of a large trucking company that owed the state of Wyoming international registration plan money, our registration fees for the state of Wyoming. So the AGs went there, and we provided the funding for them to be there to seek what they could from that bankruptcy hearing in Oklahoma.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Hubbard, how many attorneys are assigned to work with YDOT out of the AG's office?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, one full-time and a senior assistant that is assigned to us. There are two that rotate in and out as needed, and then based on the model that the AG's office has, they provide services on the personnel side as needed with a different group of attorneys, but one full time.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The two that rotate in and out, are they half time, or is it just strictly as things come up?
Mr. Chairman, I can give you dollar statistics that are associated with what we spend to support the Attorney General's role on the behalf of the Department of Transportation, but I'm not sure exactly how the full-time, part-time of each attorney, and it's also going to be based upon what specialty the Attorney General's office is going to have. They might have an attorney that has a specialization that they just assign for a short period of time. But later on in the conversation, I will show you how much money that we are providing to the Attorney General's office to support the Department of Transportation.
Anything else? Okay.
Page 21, internal review. Very long time ago, the federal government established the requirement that the Department of Transportation have an internal audit or internal review function, and the Department of Transportation has that. That function is a federal requirement, and we have an external audit every single year that's cradle to grave for the Department of Transportation. Our internal review program manages that audit independently under the director's office's programs and makes recommendations and also works with executive staff to review any particular issues that they might have a need to look at.
Yeah, on the funding for that internal review, since it's federal required, how much of that, I mean, is there a component in the commission side that steps up and pays for part of this?
Mr. Chairman, this first dollar event is transportation funded. However, we do have what's called an indirect cost allocation, which is 8.23% that we bill the feds on all of our direct costs. So we do recover those costs that are associated with the federal funds. So the federal share of dollars is covered through that, as just as well as all the other state dollars, and also for the counties if we work for them as well.
And help me get on that 8.23%. Is that there's some parameters in that and how that's negotiated? Has that been consistent? It's been consistent for quite a while. Is there any leeway to go back and revisit that, or is that tied into the federal bills as they come out of Congress?
Mr. Chairman, that is reviewed every 3 years, and that is negotiated with our federal auspice, our controlling or our largest partner, which happens to be FHWA. So they negotiate that rate every 3 years, and that rate has been effective for 3 years and is going to remain effective for the following 3 years.
John?
Mr. Chairman, just backtracking for a second here. Once in every 10 years, I get to correct Kevin Hibbard on something, and so I just can't miss this chance. It was a federal requirement at one time. That federal requirement, strictly speaking, is gone. But if you read the language on page 21, it'll tell you that the Federal Highway Administration strongly encourages that we continue with the internal audit function. And I would just tell you that as a statement of fact, that there's no way we could administer the federal funds that the DOT does administer without continuing with that function. In addition to that, I think you can catch the implication there when they strongly encourage you to do something. Now, one other thing that I'll throw in here is that the internal audit crew, it's a small crew, it's one of the smallest in the country, but they also serve some other functions within the DOT at my request and at the executive staff request. They help with process flows. They will audit at our request any function within the DOT, federal or not. And their work plan was just presented to the Transportation Commission and approved by the Commission yesterday. So if you want a copy of that, I'd be happy to get one and furnish that for you. But it'll give you a snapshot of what they actually do.
Senator Meyer.
Do you ever have an external audit either by the state audit or by independent auditors?
We have an external audit. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. We have an external audit every year. By an external auditor, and also part of that that audit, it's called the A-133, is part of that audit on the compliance side is carried out by our internal audit group on behalf of that external auditor. In addition to that, Kevin might be able to answer this in its entirety better than I, but we've been audited a number of times on various topics by the Joint Appropriations and
LSO audits.
LSO, I'm sorry.
We had LSO audits on air service enhancements and airports, also LSO audit on general fund for transportation. Those are recent audits. We've also been an audit for the Office of the Secretary of Transportation on ARRA, and we have this external audit every single year. We have extensive audit requirements for the Department of Transportation.
Okay. Anything else? Continue.
Turning to page 22, Mr. Chairman, there's a request for a replacement of a laptop for the internal review program. And I'm going to talk about the computer's process in general now for the Department of Transportation. Department of Transportation, we replace our computers on a five-year cycle. And we have an inventory that we maintain that shows us each one of those computers that need to be replaced. We control scope growth the best that we can, meaning that we don't like to add computers. We have to have a definitive reason and a purpose to have additional computers. So this inventory is based upon the standard, I would say, of the number of computers that a program has. While we replace our computers on a five-year cycle, I want to point out that that's the CPU that we replace. We don't replace the peripherals every 5 years. So if we have a monitor, for example, I had a monitor on my desk for more than 10 years. What we do is we replace that CPU so that it can keep up with the processing speed that's necessary to keep up with the changes in software. And we also don't replace printers and other peripherals until they break. We try to get the full useful life out of all of our computer equipment that we can.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thompson.
Just a follow-up on that particular issue. How long have you been on this five-year cycle? Has that been a longstanding policy of the department?
Mr. Chairman, I can dig into my bag here and answer that question directly, or perhaps you could accept that I believe it's in an area of probably three or four bienniums that we've had a five-year cycle. It might be a little bit shorter than that.
And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hibbard, I trust, since that's the standard that's contemplated in this budget, that it seems to be working fine for you.
Mr. Chairman, it does. Mr. Chairman, continuing on page 22, you'll see.
Sir?
Go ahead. Continuing on page 22, you will see the 21,906, and this is the ETS transfer. Mr. Chairman, on page 104, you'll see the unit public.
Wait, 104?
Excuse me. Yeah, I keep going to page 104. That's unit 104.
You got someplace you got to be today that you're just keep pushing this?
Yeah.
Or are you just checking to see if we're paying attention?
I got a beer plan later.
Okay.
24. It might sound like I've already had those beers, but
I wasn't going to say that.
Mr. Chairman, page 26. This is the Public Affairs Division of the Department of Transportation. They're function is to work the Department of Transportation and convey information to the citizens of Wyoming and our other stakeholders, particularly road and weather issues, construction issues. They were actively involved in the floods in 2011, and they also are responsible for the development, printing, and issuing of Wyoming's maps. You can see that the priority number 14 on the bottom of page 26 is computers. We've talked about that. And then on page 27, you'll see there's a cut, number one, of $114,425. That is reduction in professional service costs for map production. We're producing fewer maps than we have in the past, and we actually have a better price than we have had in the past. So we're reducing the professional services cost for map production by $114,425.
Well, I'm thinking about it, Don. You know, we have a five-year cycle here for YDOT. We have 2 years somewhere else. We have 3 years somewhere else. Let me know, you know, if there's any kind of consistency out there. Maybe this committee may want to jump into that because we're all over the place, and it's like a – I kid about it, but the memo went out that this is a computer year, but it's interesting how everybody needs computers, yet everybody has different replacement cycles. I'm sure that's a coincidence. Not really. Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, I snuck into my bag of tricks, and we moved to a five-year cycle in fiscal year 2010.
That was done on your own?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to take advantage of the savings costs where we can and making use of those assets as long as we could.
Okay.
The $29,188 is the ETS transfer. Unit 0401, page 32. This is Support Services Administrator Tom Laughlin's office, and he oversees driver services, motor vehicle services, motor fuel office services, those functions that Director Cox talked about earlier that came over in 1999 through reorganization. And you'll see on page 33 the exception request for the ETS transfer.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, unit 0402, page 35. This is driver services. Driver services manages the driver's license responsibility, the administrative and regulatory function of the Department of Transportation.
Yeah, before you get into the budget on that one, and I know there was a bill a couple of years ago, maybe it's 3 years ago, that requires us to do a lot of different things when we get our driver's licenses. And a lot of it's driven by Homeland Security, and a lot of it's driven by taking our federal dollars. You know, I've had people call me that, for whatever reason, aren't in our state, and they want to get their driver's license renewed, but they have to travel to our state to personally go get their driver's license. And that's just ridiculous. And I want to know, I mean, I think that's the law, and that's what we have to do. But my question is, you don't have to answer that now, but we ought to change that. And there's got to be a way. You know, you've got people that have been here, whether you're a two-year Wyoming native or, like me, a 67-year Wyoming native. For me to have to make that effort to travel to do that is just plumb ridiculous. So get back to this committee, if you would, please, if there's a way to solve that issue. At least, you know, and I understand the federal side. If we need to change the statutes and say we don't care about what you think, federal government, I'd like to know how much we give up on that. And the flip side of that, if there's some way we can facilitate within their crazy rules to allow people some flexibility. So please get that back to this committee if you would. Okay. Anything? Anybody else have anything to say about that committee? Ditto.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nicholas.
Well, perhaps with that request, if the director could present to us a breakdown of everything that's required and that isn't required, and highlight the statutory provisions from the feds and what our statutes say, so that then we can craft a bill and they can assist us in crafting a bill to make it as absolutely least restrictive as possible.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, can I make one more comment?
Sure.
On the Real ID Act? At this point in time, I'm just going to plant this as food for thought. In our opinion, the best way to approach this here going forward with regard to objections about the Real ID and the requirements of it, the best way to approach it would be to give our citizens an opt-out ability, which they would be informed of, they could do, and then they would also be informed of what's the cost if you do that, not cost money-wise, but what do you give up? Secondary screening in airport, entrance into federal facilities, or whatever that is. But because of the fact that we're better than halfway through the cycle of all of our licensed citizens actually obtaining Real ID compliant driver's licenses, there are some implications for those who have already obtained them, as well as the people who have not yet. So there might be a halfway consideration that might meet your objectives.
I think we want to look at everything and anything that's possible. But for those that have gone through it, when their license comes up again in the period that's designated, they do not have to do it again.
That's correct. So in terms of producing documents, that's a one-time.
It's a one-time deal, and so maybe let's be smart about how we do it.
Thank you.
And then see what your recommendations might be. And then the flip side of that, and Co-Chairman Harshman and I have talked to you about the open container and how we pass the law, but it's still not consistent with what the feds require in some of those areas. So I think a comprehensive analysis of that. Is that what you would be interested in, Mr. Chairman?
Well, and I think, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I think on both these issues, first of all, we want to know if some of this we've done to ourselves, if we've gone too far and with our state statutes, more than what the feds require. You know, a lot of this open container and DUI was sold to us. We'll get all of our construction money working on construction. Well, we now understand that's not the case. We have this half bottle of wine provision and this parked in the right-of-way provision piece. And so we've done a lot, and we've done some of these things. We've put a tremendous burden, you know, on our working men and women in this state. And I think, you know, several of us are interested in a CDL piece, and maybe that's all federal. You know, I see heads nodding. I guess I want to know that. Okay. Have we gone too far and done some of this to ourselves and prohibited people from working for the rest of their life?
Mr. Chairman, in our last meeting, this topic came up. And last night or yesterday afternoon, I signed the first of two reports that I'm giving you. So the first one has been sent as of last evening, and that addresses the repeat offender open container and the implications of that. And those parts of the law that don't match up with the federal requirements. As regards DUI, and hang on one second. As regards your request for information on the DUI side, and the other topic that you brought up was relevant to crash reports and suspected alcohol involvement. That's
right.
The question that came up in November. That we're putting that information together. We've got the information. I just haven't crafted it into a report for you. That should be forthcoming just within a matter of days here. But the one that I referenced earlier was the repeat offender open container. Now, with regard to the question about CDLs, that is federal. And so when you have something that hits your driver's license that affects the CDL status, that we don't have a choice on those issues, okay? I think that seems to me that we'll try to address it. I don't know about specifics, but somebody said something about somebody being arrested for driving a lawnmower.
So if you're arrested, Mr. Chairman, if you're arrested in your personal vehicle, blood alcohol limits that are more stringent with a CDL apply there also maybe, and so – all those kind of things, I think, we have questions about.
Okay,
and we've done that to ourselves, some of those just state rules.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we have. I think what you're seeing in terms of the impact on somebody that is a CDO holder is traceable directly to federal rule and reg, and that is a very strict environment. With regard to the DUI law and that kind of thing, much of what has been toughened up in the Wyoming DUI law is not more than what is encouraged or required at the federal level, and frankly, I don't think we've done that to ourselves at all. Let me make the same or a similar comment about the Real ID rules that have made their way into Wyoming statute. Wyoming adopted a set of rules to be compliant minimally with Real ID. We did not. We intentionally, in our discussions with the committee and the legislature, we intended to do what we had to do in order to be compliant. But I don't, in my opinion, we have not overshot that in any way. I'm not sure that there's any, if nothing had been implemented so far on a driver's license, no new Real ID compliant driver's license had been yet issued. I don't know and we were in that kind of. Decision-making capability, I don't know that we'd be in a position where we could back off and remain compliant. I think we've done the minimum. But we'll get you details on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Just 1 second. You through, Steve?
Well, I guess so in the last couple minutes what I've heard then, and I'm going to rephrase how I understand it, all of our open container requirements and all of our DUI laws and repeat offender law, our DUI laws and repeat DUI laws for regular license CDL are federally compliant as far as construction money.
No.
Not open container. I'm talking DUI. Does the federal government have compliance issues with highway funding for DUIs?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Lofton, Wyoming Department of Transportation. Mr. Chairman, the CDL sanctions, essentially with the commercial driver's license, are the minimum federal requirements. That's what we've put across ever since day one with the commercial driver's license program. Mr. Chairman, there are actual sanctions for failure to comply with the CDL. Those sanctions are up to 10% of your highway funds. And
is that 10%, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, 10% lost or 10% like the safety deal where we spend
Mr.
it on
Chairman,
safety issues?
Mr. Chairman, that is a 10% loss.
Okay,
that
you.
Is not a diversion. And, Mr. Chairman, what's more concerning to the department and to the state and most of the trucking industry is should we decide not to comply with the CDL requirements, one of the sanctions would result in Wyoming CDLs not being recognized in
other
states.
So you're not interstate anymore.
Mr. Chairman, our drivers would actually have to go to another state and get a non-resident CDL to do their job.
Okay. And then on, Mr. Chairman, and then on the, are there federal requirements on for non-CDL license similar to these that where there's withholdings or punishments on funding?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, most of those are deal with the diversion program, and I think others.
So there's no cuts, Mr. Chairman. So what I hear really, the feds, really it's the interstate issue with CDLs and not our Class C license, those kind of things. Those are strictly all our decisions, and if there is some federal punishments in the form of a safety construction diversion issue, similar to our open container.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that.
Yeah, and the Real ID, if we had not complied with that, what would have happened? Is that, again, a diversion of funds, or is that a reduction?
Mr. Chairman, that would not be either one of those. It would be the failure of federal buildings, air travel, those type things, of them not accepting our driver's license as a primary form of identification.
Oh, so when you go through the lines at DIA and you show a Wyoming driver's license, they'd have a little thing in their computer that kicks it out so you can't get on the plane? Is that what?
Mr. Chairman, for those that actually have one of the new licenses, if you look in the top right-hand corner of that license, there's a little emblem. And that emblem tells TSA that you have a compliant driver's license. Some of our early compliant licenses that we issue do not have the STAR, but they're still accepted until the next rotation. So you may have complied with all the requirements, but you don't have the little STAR on there because there was a period of time we had to wait for certification before we could put the STAR on there.
How many of the committee got a little STAR on their license?
Not me.
They were all grabbing our wallets. Those that have any wallets. Mr. Chairman, you through?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just and then there is this group of folks who really. So the message is, if you have a CDL and you're not commercially driving anymore, but you just have it to keep hold of it, because we've sold it to our citizens. It's like an associate's degree in college. I mean, you're earning power. But if you're not using it anymore, really the message is to drop it. If there's because the requirements and the punishments, and particularly the blood alcohol level, are different than our Class C license. So really that's the message, I think, and we're hearing from folks that say, I'm giving up my CDL.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. A lot of folks don't need a CDL and probably should go ahead and downgrade that license.
And that's a .04.
Yes, but Mr. Chairman, the .04 only applies when they're driving their commercial vehicle.
Yeah, and so the
guy. So if they're in their car, Mr. Chairman, then the .08 kicks in. But it still results in the disqualification for 1 year of their commercial license.
Yeah, but what happened, Mr. Chairman, if I've got my license, I used to have a CDL, and I don't anymore, but if in fact I got picked up for a DUI, but I blew .06, they would take my license away from me that said CDL on it, and then I would have nothing to be able to drive. Now, has that changed?
Mr. Chairman, if you're looking at doing the BAC thing, the .04 and above only applies while operating a commercial motor vehicle.
Yeah, but my question is, that is on the license we have. It says CDL on it. There's not two separate ones. There's one.
Mr. Chairman, that license is actually a privilege to drive a commercial vehicle and all vehicles below that.
Right.
So the rules for a Class C would still apply to you while operating a Class C vehicle. So if you blew a .04 in a private vehicle, the rules for a private vehicle would apply, not the commercial rules.
Yeah, but if you blow .04 in a commercial and you want to drive your private vehicle, they've got your driver's license.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Yeah.
What would happen then is you would be downgraded to a Class C license.
Well, you could still drive your car, but you'd have to reapply, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, just for my wrap-up on this, so our state statutes and rules mirror the federal requirements. Don't go above them. And so those are, for like a CDL, what is it? It's 1 year revocation of your CDL. Maybe just walk us through that 1 year, 2 year. We know we got felony DUI.
Mr. Chairman, the CDL rules are somewhat more stringent. It is a 1 year, they call it a disqualification. So it is a 1 year disqualification from operating a commercial vehicle for a first offense. And Mr. Chairman, at that point, it starts going to essentially what they call lifetime, which can be reviewed at 5 years for reinstatement.
So the second one, then, it's lifetime, but you guys have a review process at 5 years.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
And so, really, there is no person that in that boat, they're going to get another line of work. They have to get another line of work or go on, assistance, and unless they get a five-year review, favorable review. Have you had any of those? Are we that far out yet with the new laws?
Go ahead.
We're probably not there yet.
Mr. Chairman, these rules actually were put into place in 2004.
Oh, they were? The lifetime ban? Is that right?
2004 was when we changed it from, as a federal requirement, from just in a commercial vehicle to in any vehicle.
You know what I think we need to do, Mr. Chairman, is for you, from Representative Nicholas's question and add to walk us through that a little bit, if you would, please, in kind of a short summary, because there's confusion on that. And you know, the only thing I would add to it, Mr. Co-Chair, is you think it's ugly with a commercial driver's license, you ought to try it with a pilot's license. Yeah. Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just along those lines, when you talk about jobs and the license I hold to operate a train, that the companies that are out there, you know, their rules are even more strict. I mean, if I get a DUI, I have to notify my company within 24 hours and probably go to treatment or something. But, you know, you're out of work there. But, like, I made a point last week that the van drivers that transport railroad workers around, and I've talked to the former head of the Highway Patrol. I haven't really discussed it with Mr. Butler, but those guys, you know, they do background checks on those, and if they have a DUI on there, they can't drive for those companies. And like I said, that company was even having a hard time finding workers. They went into the homeless shelter and said, who holds a driver's license? And that's how they were able to find people to work for. So it's even more stringent than you might think.
Okay, well, I'm not sure any of us will get to drive home this weekend, but
just one quick question. What's the 5-year what do you go through on the 5-year review? What do you evaluate? And can you get reinstated if you've been clean for 5 years, if you've had two for your commercial driver's license?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to do a review on that. Off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that right. And I'm thinking it's 5 years. It may be 10, but I was thinking it was 5.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's really the issue. We hear so many things.
Yeah.
Our constituents are bugging us, and they say they call your offices, and they're told lifetime, then they're told 10, then they're told 5, and then they're told I don't know. Then they're told it's a federal, and then they tell it's a fed, say it's a state. We don't really know. And we don't know how much we've done this to ourselves, if any, and now we hear the feds have done it to us. So, you know, to really serve our people, we want to get the scoop. And if we can tell our constituents, hey, it's 5 years from your second one, if you're clean and you do the right thing, hey, you'll have a chance to get back to work. I'd like to know that so I can tell people. And I think that's, you know, so if you can get back with us, we'd sure appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly will.
And then I think the issue needs to get out to all your folks who answer these calls from people so they can give them the right information. Okay, and then they're not emailing us about it. And then we're not spending a half hour budget time working it. But I will tell you, all this has been sold to us as a budgetary item. Get all our construction money back, which I'm disappointed to say we don't have yet. So, but anyway, I'll leave it with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, one more comment.
Okay, and no, this is a comment. This is a question, Mr. Chairman. Question is on the open container. Is there a proportional reduction or diversion, rather? It's not a reduction. Proportional diversion as far as compliance, or if we had no open container law in our books at all right now, would the diversion funds be exactly the same as they are now, which is a open container law, which is partially in compliance?
I think I know the answer, but go ahead, John.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is it would be the same either way. And I don't know if
okay.
That question was actually raised in November, or we were just smart enough to think to ask it. But we did ask that, and it's an all or nothing.
Yeah, and just okay. To put this to closure, and we have your report on this, your agency handout. The way I read it is $134 million has been diverted because of these compliance issues. But what the thing that we have done is we spent it in other areas that we might have spent the money anyway. So I guess that's a fair assessment. Is that correct?
That's a fair assessment, Mr. Chairman. I can give you a real fast detail of how that
works. It is what it is, and none of us like it.
And it is.
And if you can figure out how to change it, we want to know.
And it is detailed in the report that we provided you.
Okay, that's handout 136, everybody has. Okay, let's get back to the budget.
Mr. Chairman, a house cleaning item real quick. You asked earlier about the comparison of federal funds and state funds on a national level. That's on our slide number 9. There's 4 associated slides to that. So when you look into our presentation, go to slide number 9.
And what that doesn't show is regional. It just shows national.
It shows all the states. Each state and federal dollars in a comparison, and it shows the statistics, the actual math, and so it's every single state, what they're getting in federal funds, what they're getting in state funds. And
yeah. Okay, let's go on.
We're on page 35. We're speaking driver services, and I think I'll not have to explain what driver services does, obviously. The exception request number one, priority number eight on page 35, iVision for $72,000. The governor's recommendation on that is to approve. On page number 36, priority nine, $20,300 for void machines. When we have an old license, we have a void machines. The current void machines are a little bit antiquated, but the governor recommended denial. Number three, priority to 10, telephone recording system. That was also denied by the governor. Priority number 16, computer replacements. We discussed computer replacements. There's 59 desktops to be replaced in driver services for $44,250. That was approved. And that finishes up the discussion for driver services.
Yeah, in more ways than one.
Mr. Chairman, Unit 0403, page 41. This is Motor Vehicle Services. We talked a little bit about this earlier. This program manages our international registration plan, our titling, our motor vehicle registrations, assists the counties with the collection and administration of those responsibilities. The priority number 28, reduction in budget authority, there's $146,064. This is a YDOT cut. This is on page 42. We've looked at our budgets, and we can do with less. And also you have a $39,312 ETS transfer. Mr. Chairman, page 45, unit 0405. This is the Department of Transportation's human resource plan. They assist our programs with the human resource responsibilities for the 2,048 department employees. On page 46, you'll see the professional fee decrease to $34,186. That's largely due to the fact that currently we don't need to advertise so much as we did prior to the recession. We're in a recession. We have plenty of people applying for jobs, so we've cut $34,186 on the department level and also $21,168 for ETS transfers. Moving on, 0400, 0406, which would be on page 49. This is our management services offices. John talked about our challenges on a federal level. Our management services office is integral to our watching and influencing and working with Congress on our reauthorization of federal funds. They have other missions associated with the direction of the Department of Transportation.
Hold on
and
a second.
Staff.
Reverend Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on the HR thing that you were just visiting about, how do you, and I think we probably talked about this before, but I don't remember, since we have, what'd you say, 500 and some employees on the legislatively appropriated side and a bunch twice that or more on the other side, for HR functions and things like that, how is the legislatively appropriated dollars providing those services for the entire agency workforce, or is that split between those two budgets?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, in reorganization, that bill that was passed by the legislature, the human resource function that was identified to be a legislative appropriated budget, and that legislative budget and those folks do the entire Department of Transportation's human resource effort, legislative and commission, but their funding and their positions reside in the legislative appropriated side of the budget.
Okay.
Not to be confused with general funds, just legislatively overseen and appropriated.
Okay. Got it?
0406, office services. Office services provide integral functions, archiving records. They also handle the postal responsibilities in the Department of Transportation. On page 50, you'll see the request prior number 30. $50,960, which is an ETS transfer, and I apologize. There's one prior to that for $2,250 for three desktop computers. We've discussed computers previously. Moving on. And I'll slow down just a little bit here for 407. 0400, 0407 on page 54. This is operating transfers out to other state agencies. The Department of Transportation pays for services that other state agencies provide to the Department of Transportation. We earlier discussed the Attorney General's office. In the statewide cost allocation plan, we transfer funds to other agencies. We intend to transfer on an annual basis $410,928 to the Attorney General's office, basically about $800,000 on a biennium basis. Also included in that are the Office of Hearing Examiners, ANI Risk Management, State Archives, Department of Revenue, et cetera. I could go through those in detail, Mr. Chairman, but we do pay for all the services that are provided by other state agencies, including ETS.
Yeah, and you're looking at 52 under office services. That's where you are, right? Are you? Where exactly is that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm on page 54.
It's on 54, and what's the, and so then the, you're talking about the, but you're still talking about office services.
No, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I'm talking about statewide cost allocation.
Okay, statewide cost.
The funds that the Department of Transportation pay to support the services provided by other state agencies to the Department of Transportation.
That's a big number.
That is a big number, Mr. Chairman. I could walk you through each one of those if you'd like me to.
Well, first question is, if you look at your base budget, and I understand how you calculate that compared to your standard, there's about $3.5 million difference. Why is that? What was one time or different? What's the difference there?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the ETS transfer that we've talked about. You've seen repeatedly in my conversation today that we're reducing budgets.
That's
elsewhere.
The 27 people that you talked about.
And we're increasing it here.
Okay. And then if this has the Attorney General in it as well, you said 800,000.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So, but you're still 15 million. So what are some other big ones?
Some other big ones would be, and I'm just going, there's actually a slide.
Why don't you just provide that breakdown? That's simpler.
It's in our presentation already. It's
where?
In the commission presentation that we provided to you.
It's in that one.
It's in that one,
okay.
Yes.
You know, that's a problem when we get two different budgets. You come in and you give us one, and then we remember that and look at it, then we flip to this, and you deal in it every day. We don't, and that's where
right.
We get confused. And
that's correct.
And I don't know
Mr.
how you rectify that, but it's in there. So,
Mr.
Okay.
Chairman, the Department of Transportation does have a very large wingspan, and their budget is complicated. Not only for
we can understand budgets, but when you flip back and forth, we don't deal in a day-to-day basis like you do.
Yeah.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman,
question.
Over here.
Brett.
Mr. Chairman, on page 55, I did just want to point out to you, you may recall we talked about these permanently assigned ETS positions, and there is a number on this page for the 27 positions that have been referred to already, and you would see it in the 0405 object code, the direct bill positions. It's the $4.6 million. It's also included on the summary that we provided you, I think, earlier this week, just showing you where those positions and the appropriated dollars are throughout the legislatively appropriated budgets.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Stubson, did you have something or you're just – okay. All right, please continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the statewide cost allocation has increased, and that's – largely due to the transfer for ETS, but that's not an increase to state government. That's simply transferring responsibilities from one place to the other. On page 56, 0400, 0408, this is management services. And management services I talked about earlier. I think I actually made a mistake, Mr. Chairman. I talked about office services. Management services is the one that provides the services for our legislative activities, and that was they have $3,200 for computers, and they also have on page 57, they have $14,080 for an ETS transfer. Mr. Chairman, on page 60, procurement services. This would be unit 0400-0411, page 60, purchasing in the Department of Transportation. Focuses largely on those commodities that the Department of Transportation needs for roads. It would be asphalt, delineator posts, delineator buttons, paint, etc. There is one desktop asked for replacement of $750. We discussed the computers, and there's also on the page bottom of page 61, you'll see that the Department of Transportation is reducing a budget by $1,197, and also an ETS transfer of $54,792.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Just a broad question. In your opinion, Director, has the ETS transfers improved your office management, or is it not improved?
Is that the only two choices I have, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead. Who wants that one?
Mr. Chairman, I think YDOT had an advantage during the standing up of the ETS agency, and that advantage was, and this was negotiated with the approval of the governor's office, that was that because of the size of our operation and the specifics of our IT workforce, we were able to negotiate that while those employees went to the Department of ETS, they actually remained assigned, most of them, remained assigned at YDOT. So in the general sense, I would tell you that the ETS transfer is really kind of a wash for us. We're getting the same level. I won't lie to you, it's more of a challenge for the IT people. And there was a few that were kept behind that were very program-specific, subject matter experts and stuff like that. And that, you know, some of that is still a process of evolving into the new culture and all that. But I think in the general sense, I would call it a break-even process so far for us. We're spending the same money. There might be a little more money involved for us in some cases, but it's largely break-even today.
Mr. Chairman, do you have additional overtime costs or for the ones that went to the other office? Are you getting less production out of them?
Last question first. The production out of them I don't think is a problem at all, simply because these were people that had to go through a considerable, really an emotional adjustment, the idea of being transferred against their will to another agency. They wanted to stay right where they were. I don't know about overtime costs. Kevin, do you know if that's gone up?
Kevin, you got any?
Mr. Chairman, I have no reason to believe that there's any change in the total amount of overtime.
Okay. On the procurement services budget, you know, I'm just curious, your salary classified from base to standard went up about $12,000. Explain that to me. And then your space rental standard to base to standard went up. And just what's going on there with both those two? Page 63. I'm looking at, you know, salary 0103, and I'm looking at 0520.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pulling up the Chapter 17 report that has detail on the changes in the salary.
Did you reclassify? Is that what it was? Or
procurement services? Yes. Position number 0159 was reclassified from a BAA-SO3 to a BAA-SO5. That was a position reclassification.
And Don, is this part, excuse me, Dave, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but Don, is this part of the reclassification we were looking at in terms of salary creep with all state agencies? This would fit into that category, correct? Either Don.
Mr. Chairman, overall, the Department of Transportation and their legislative side had a net reduction in salary, so there was no creep. And if there had been, it would have been on the highway funding, not general fund.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
And then the space rental, what was that?
Can I just add one more comment to the Chapter 17 report? The Department of Transportation reduced its total labor budget by $1,634,743, largely due to older
people,
long-term veterans retiring and new entry employees taking those positions. And the space rental, every biennium we go through an analysis of square footage in the Department of Transportation, and we allocate that total square footage that each program occupies, and then we allocate that to the budget. So in this case, the purchasing division, their allocation based upon how much square footage that they have, all the utilities and everything associated with their buildings, is increased from $90,070 to $106,000.
So this wouldn't necessarily be rental, but your utilities are another part of the budget. So this is space rental, though.
Mr. Chairman, in the Department of Transportation, the space rental budget for the legislative side includes both those items that if we rent, because we do have rentals for driver services, and or if the Department of Transportation owns that property itself. It includes both in this line item. So in this case, with purchasing, they are in our facilities, and the entire cost of that facility, including utilities, is included in that space rental for our Department of Transportation.
Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I'm on page 65. And page would be unit 0400-0402, and that would be strategic performance improvement. This program is a very small program in the Department of Transportation, but they are responsible for maintaining the strategic plan responsibilities for the department, and also works with the programs to better to look for efficiencies and manages the balanced scorecards for the organization. On page
do they work in coordination? You know, each individual district, and maybe this is a question for Dell, where you have your, I forget the acronym, but where we have those meetings a couple times a year to talk about the proposed highway improvements for an area. Does this, your overall strategic plan, do they coordinate with those local? I think it might be STIP, trying to remember what the terminology is. Dell?
Mr. Chairman, Dell McComey, Chief Engineer. Mr. Chairman, no, they don't. On the STIP, that is handled by the districts, and then our planning office coordinate those meetings. This office does meet, however, with all of our districts and the individual programs, be it construction or maintenance. Each of our districts has a balanced scorecard that leads up both from, say, the maintenance level into the overall district level, which then leads into conformance with the executive staff's strategic plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, on page 66, you'll see the budget request to reduce this program by the Department of Transportation's request of $7,309 and also the ETS transfer $6,048. Mr. Chairman, unit 0400-0413, which would be on page 69. This is our 69. This is our fuel tax administration program. They administer the collection and distribution of our motor fuel taxes. They have a computer purchase on the bottom of page 69. They have a reduction of budget authority to transfer to ETS on page 70.
Hey, John, on those fuel taxes, you know, is that coming in? The revenue projections are pretty consistent with what you estimated. You know, now that we've been into a little bit, or is it still too early to tell?
Kevin is the guru on that, but the last report I saw was just slightly lower, but not much. It's really not significant at this point.
So our estimates are pretty fairly close. Okay, mm-hmm. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, on page 74, we have law enforcement, the highway patrol. On page 75, I think we all know the troopers and the highway patrol. On page 75, we have a priority number 3, mobile data terminals. Mobile data terminals are devices, the computer inside a patrol car, that operate all the functions inside the patrol car. They interact with the video camera, the microphones, the GPS for the trooper locations. Warrant information can be received directly by the troopers in the field. They also can verify the Verisol, which would be the liability insurance that a driver has or does not have. And it also facilitates electronic citation submission to the courts for in real time. We're asking for $1.5 million to replace the mobile data terminals. Mr. Chairman, these are targeted to be paid for with federal funds, and those federal funds are repeat offender open container.
We have there's $1.5 million over in the judiciary budget that deals with some e-citations. And is there any, this is a replacement, so what they're doing is different. And the question I have is based on where they're going with that, is there some kind of a logical progression to utilize before you go ahead and replace these based on what judiciary might do with their budget, or Are they really totally, we're talking about two separate things? Maybe John can answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, Colonel John Butler. Yes, we are working with them in this. What this is for is to once again upgrade our in-car computer systems and we have been working with the Supreme Court for several years to get this e-citation, and this is just one of those elements on our part that actually helps in that process.
So if you get this and you get the money and you do your replacement, that it'll be consistent and compatible with what you might or might not do with the judiciary system on their 1.5 million. Is that a fairly good response? Or I mean, that's what will happen then.
Mr. Chairman, we've been working with the Supreme Court on this, and we have been the guinea pig's probably the wrong word, but we've been the one working through all the bugs with this process. So we already are working with them. It works with their system so that it and actively today we're shy of just a couple of troopers short of being trained in this. We are working this in many spots already around the state to
and is this, is this federal fund a grant that you apply for? How do you get them? The next question is, if you get it for replacement, is there any opportunity to utilize some of those grants for what we're trying to do with judicial courts? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, to answer the first question is yes. The repeat offender up container set-asides and how we use those funds have to be approved by the National Highway Safety Traffic Administration, or NHTSA.
So this is the open container money.
That's correct.
So why don't we just use some of that to eliminate the $1.5 million general funds over in the courts? Could we just expand that and do that since it's this money that's being redirected?
If you don't want us to use it on the highway. Most of the vast majority of those funds
well,
that are
these
diverted.
Are replacements for
correct and in this case we've been approved to use that funding at the federal level on this equipment, so we're able to use those diversion funds in part for that. So I assume that
Mr. Chairman, the funding for repeat offender open container, if the mission or the budget or the activity that you want to spend the money for can be directly attributed to reducing the states and the federal and the citizens' exposure to repeat offenders and also DUI issues, crashes, et cetera. If you can tie that directly to that, then those funds can qualify. So in the case of the highway patrol, the troopers, we can make the direct tie to their mission to curtail repeat offenses and also DUI. With the in-car video data terminals, we can document that and prove that these funds qualify for that expenditure.
Well, I think you could take that a step further and do what they're trying to do with the courts, but I'm not going to get in your business. But more importantly, you know, there's some money out there that you know, some of this $134 million we just talked about that we have to divert. I'm not sure how you spend that, but maybe you could think about that might be a way to offset the $1.5 million general fund money we're putting into the courts. If that's a good use of those funds, if it isn't, then it isn't. But at least let's think about it. You don't have to do it now. Just think about that, and
Mr.
we got
Chairman,
time to.
I give you a yes, and that should be qualified by saying we probably have to check into whether or not that money could be applied to the Supreme Court of the judiciary initiative that you're talking about. The 130 some million, I think, is the total, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, it's a total over a number of years.
Yeah. Okay.
That's over a number of years. Okay. It's a summation of it.
Yes, sir.
Just give that some thought. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, I'm going to talk about the report that we provided on repeat offender open container. Yes, since 2001, the Department of Transportation, because of the repeat offender open containers, state law in Wyoming has not met the expectations of NHTSA. There has been a transfer of funds of $134 million, of which $117 million has been targeted. Of the $134 million, $117 million of that would be targeted directly at the highways, reducing safety-related aspects that we would probably normally do anyway. So these funds, this $117 million, is going to do the highway road construction projects most likely we'd normally do. We have had $6.4 million that's been identified to use to facilitate the highway patrol's mission where it's directly associated with the repeat offense vendors and DUI folks operating vehicles, $6.4 million. And the largest share of that has been for the these mobile data terminals. Lastly, the remaining portion of the repeat offender open container amount of funds that have been used is $10 million, and that has been used for highway safety program alcohol-impaired driving countermeasures. So of the total $134 million, the lion's share, the majority, has been still applied to the highways.
Yeah, and Don, you know, what we ought to do, and it's kind of hard to just make a knee-jerk decision on this. To me, it seems like it's something we could do, but rather than just do it in markup and say we're doing it, maybe we could put a footnote or at least earmark that to think about a way to maybe better utilize some of these funds and have some direction from the legislature. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to not only try to find that out for you, but we're also going to broaden it. We're just on a sidebar here talking about the other highway safety funds that come through NHTSA, not highway funds, but highway safety stuff, highway traffic safety stuff. I'm kind of wondering if there are any of those other funds that could be maybe brought to bear on that. We're just going to have to find out.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up on the bottom of 76 and throughout your budget. I noticed the governor approves most of it and denies a portion of it. Is that based on ETS feedback on what they think those really would cost you? Or?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Early in the budget process, we contacted ETS. They provided us a statistic later on. They sharpened the pencil and got a better price, and then they made those changes for us. So, yes, it's ETS-driven.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, on page 76, priority number 21, computer replacements. We've discussed those. Page 77, reduction in budget authority, $574,680 ETS transfer. Mr. Chairman, page 81, radioactive waste. Mr. Chairman, currently the state of Wyoming collects $200 per cask of radioactive waste that's transported in Wyoming. That $200 per cask goes into a special fund that the Department of Transportation administers. We have worked directly with the Office of Homeland Security because they have a mirror request to fund a position. This request on page 81, which is prior number 23, uses radioactive waste in support of a mirror exception request that you should find in the Homeland Security's budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
And Mr. Hibbert, could you explain, I don't know what you mean by a mirror exception. Is that they're funding an entirely different position, or they're including funding for half the position in theirs?
Mr. Chairman, this exception is in the Department of Transportation's budget because we are going to transfer radioactive waste funds to fund a position in Homeland Security. And they have the very same request so that you can see the tie to their budget and our budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, how much is in that fund?
Mr. Chairman. We began the fiscal period of 2014 with $521,285. With the current budget that we're going to support the Homeland Security with, we anticipate to end the fiscal period with $540,936.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. I think we get the ports of entry.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, 0500, 0504, page 84, you'll see on the bottom a computer we've discussed. The next page, 85, you can see an ETS transfer we've discussed. Moving along, 0600, 0601, this is Wylink. There's two units under 0600, which is the appropriation unit, and there's
page 90. Go ahead.
There's this unit on page 90, and this is what we used to refer to as SALEX, State Agency Law Enforcement Communications System. There are seven positions in this budget, and they provide dispatching for agencies not within the Department of Transportation. That dispatching is charged to these other agencies that take advantage of that base 75% of the usage that they have in dispatching and 25% of the number of radios that they have that we dispatch to. I have the list of folks that we provide the service to, the Game and Fish, 70.46%, Parks and Cultural Resources, 18.8%, Brand Inspectors, 8.58%, Livestock Board, 2.42%, Board of Outfitters, 0.36%. Mr. Chairman, is there any questions on the first unit within Wild Inc. or SALEX?
Questions? Nope.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit would be Wild Link. That's 0600-0603 on page 92. Mr. Chairman, the exception requests that we have in this budget today are precisely what we advised this committee last year in the supplemental process. These exception requests that I will discuss in detail are ongoing costs. There are no one-time costs within this budget. We anticipate that these costs will be necessary in future bienniums. We understand the governor has made recommendation of one-time costs for funding source purposes. We understand that, but we just want to make sure that the Appropriations Committee is not confused or that we haven't been transparent in the fact that these costs will be asked for again in the future.
How much money have we spent on WildLink year to date?
Mr. Chairman, we've had a total amount of budget of $90.7 million. We've spent $84.4 million of that to date. And, you know, that's when I did the report. We've had some large transactions since then. But
tell me, how do you monitor? Do you have a way of knowing, like, calls per day, amount of minutes? How do you monitor the success of this thing, other than a lot of us don't think it works very well? Is there a way to look at that so you can somehow have a cost-benefit or an analysis?
Mr. Chairman, Ken Schultz, Wyoming Department of Transportation, Assistant Chief Engineer for Operations. We do have a continuous monitoring system, and every radio that's on the system affiliates with the system with a unique ID. And so we can monitor all usage on the system to the point that we can actually, if we could actually turn radios off if we had to. But
how many radios are there?
There are over 16,000 radios currently on the system statewide. Those radios are distributed amongst not only the state agencies, but federal agencies, the FBI, the Forest Service, the BLM, as examples, as well as many of the, and most are local agencies, fire districts, the local law enforcement folks, and there are a lot of folks. School buses are on the system as a, you know, for emergency response purposes.
So if I'm on that and I have a radio and I've got my other radios and then I've got my cell phone, are each of them individual? So the WildLink radio that I have that has a unique ID, that is a specific radio for that frequency, and that's what it's for. Period. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, there are radios that will work on multiple radio systems, and when they are switched to those channels for those other systems, they function according to that system. But when they're functioning on the WildLink system, they have a unique identifier.
So you've got a radio in your pickup, and it's got channel 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. One of them's WildLink. That's a simple way of explaining it.
Correct, and you can have, and when you're on WildLink, it affiliates with that system. It's associated with that system at that point in time.
Do you have a way of determining how many emergency calls are taken in a week or anything for effectiveness in that regard, or is it just?
Mr. Chairman, it's we don't have a way of determining whether they're emergency calls as such. We have a count of calls, and I think the number of calls that we've used in the past year, we monitor that all the time. In 2013, the radio had over 20 million calls associated with it, and we have a graph that I could provide you if you would like, but and then we monitor the usage based on that. Most of the significant usage on the system is the local agencies, quite frankly, because they are that's the biggest number that's there.
So we have the ongoing $1.5 million per year of these management contracts. Is that correct then?
Mr. Chairman, the entire budget that we have in front of you for WildLink today is ongoing. All three of these exception requests that I'll walk you through, they're all ongoing.
Okay, how much a year to operate WildLink that's ongoing is it? And I understand these requests. You got 3 million for the two maintenance agreements plus what you have already, so it's roughly 4 million a biennium.
Mr. Chairman, if you go to page 96, you'll see the bottom right-hand corner. The budget is for 15 and 16 is $5.6 million for the biennium 15 and 16.
And that includes these maintenance contracts?
That's correct.
Who do you negotiate those with?
Our vendor, Motorola.
And we're locked into that because they provided the system, and we're pretty much at their mercy other than whatever you think you can negotiate, correct?
Mr. Chairman, the simple answer to that question would be yes.
Yes, okay.
Mr. Chairman, I will detail the three budget requests here. If you start on page 92, you'll see.
Before you do, does this have to do with highway safety?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is no.
Well, why would it?
It's not highway safety. You pay defender open container. It's the highway safety, sure, yeah, for the safety of the highway system.
Yeah.
On page 92.
I don't know that I. Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, the WildLink is Wyoming Public Safety Communication System, and the Highway Patrol does use that, so that does result in our mission to keep the highway safe. On page 92, the first exception budget request is priority number 6, service agreement for WildLink hardware. These are the hardware maintenance fees that we have for the upcoming biennium. It's at $1.6 million. This is for the local government's portion of the hardware maintenance. We also have hardware maintenance for the Highway Patrol's portion that is funded outside of this $1.6 million. The government has recommended that this be funded from the Strategic Investment Project account. That's on page 93. The second aspect of this is the
software. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, how soon will the hardware have to be replaced? We hear numbers on computer hardware, you know, every 2 years. Your computers are every 5. How often will this hardware have to be replaced?
Mr. Chairman, the Motorola cycle on this stuff is not really set quite in stone yet, but we've had this system in place now, portions of this system, for a good 10 years, and so there's pieces that we're going to have to replace soon, because 10 years is a long time for that. There's some dispatch consoles that will not function after we upgrade the software beyond the next upgrade that we're at. And then there will be some mountaintop repeaters that we're going to have to change for the same reason. And they're tied into the computer system, so they're going to be in there. And we've got plans and some things for that as well, and obviously we'll have future requests to look at that.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So, say in the next 3 years, how much of that has to be replaced, and a rough round ballpark figure of the cost?
Mr. Chairman, we briefed this committee last year in the supplemental budget process about what we expected the budget to be for 15 and 16, and you're seeing that request as we briefed it for you last year. We are going to be working with the Public Safety Communications Commission, the governor's staff, and WIDOT, and we're going to establish the needs, the alternatives, and also the recommendations of what the 17 and 18 budget will be. When we meet with you next time or a year from now, we will have an estimate of what we think 17 and 18's budget is going to be. So what you're looking at today is for what we're going to accomplish in 15 and 16.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Oh, Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are you saying that the governor's claimed they're all one-time funding? You're saying you might be able to find some other source to fund these into the future?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not claiming that the governor has made the statement that this is one-time funding. He is using a one-time funding source for this current biennium. What I'm saying is I don't want the committee to be confused that these requests are actually ongoing requests. You're going to see them again in 17 and 18.
Go ahead, Representative Thompson. And then we'll
Mr.
get
Chairman,
Wallace.
Maybe to follow up on that with Mr. Jones, maybe some thought on why, if we know these are reoccurring, what was the thought process about taking them out of the SIPA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, first and foremost, the governor is supportive overall of the WildLink system. There were some efforts last year following appropriation decisions to follow up with the B-11 in support of the system and the funding needs associated with that, and I believe he had some dialogue with legislative leadership as well as departmental leadership in the execution of that B-11. Secondly, he does understand the ongoing nature of the costs associated with the WildLink system. His recommendation, he did believe that SIPA was appropriate as long as his recommendation was one time for the funding needs identified here. He does feel that periodically revisiting the WildLink system and the costs associated with it makes sense, which is why you see the both the use of the SIPA as well as the one-time recommendation overall. I will also point out on page 93, you'll note his recommendation related to the utilization of pooled interest, and specifically that pooled interest associated with what my understanding is the original WildLink appropriation that was moved over to the Department of Transportation. He believes that pooled interest, if there's a balance remaining of it, and apparently there is, should be transferred to the general fund. So he also wanted to highlight that in the context of this recommendation. You may recall, I believe it was either in the supplemental or 2 years ago, there was a similar proposal from the agency to utilize pooled interest as well. And I believe the source of funding for that was the same. It was interest earned off the original WildLink appropriation. So hopefully that clarifies where the governor was coming from with respect to his recommendations on WildLink.
And Mr. Chairman, that raises a follow-up question then for you, Mr. Hibbard, on what is the balance of interest on that original appropriation?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on page 93, you can see that our original request of the $1.6 million was to have it be a $905,598 of general funds standard and also $694,402 of pooled interest. That's what we have in the specific account that we manage WildLink in. That's the interest that was earned on the cash balance that's available to fund WildLink or to transfer back to the general fund. It's either or, and we want to be transparent with it. We want to make sure that you know that that money's there and then make the decision on how best recommend how we handle it.
And how much money is that again?
Currently, there's $694,402 of interest available to transfer.
That's
for
all.
Use.
That's all the interest there is available, correct?
That's correct.
How much is the principal?
The principal balance on the current WildLink fund.
$9 million probably, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something in that neighborhood. I'm thinking that's close. I can dig out if you'd like me to, but I think it's about that amount of money.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Wallace had one. Okay, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quick on the, you know, you changed the billing system. You're going to roll out a new billing for the locals, just what I read in your narrative. But talked about the 2 million radio transmissions in the past year. And so as we look at all the potential users again, just so we have these questions from our colleagues, and I want to state, federal, locals, what percentage do we got on board? I mean, are we getting close to getting everybody, or is there a percentage you can say, hey, 70% of Wyoming's on this?
Mr. Chairman, I can't give you an exact percentage now, but I can certainly look it up and get you that. Ballpark, I would say about 80.
About 80.
We have some areas where WildLink is not finished.
Okay.
On the original build-out, and we need to finish that. And there's a couple of areas where we've finished, but there are some coverage gaps that we need to fill, and we're working to do those as well.
Just another quick question, you know, on constituents bringing, we've had conversations. You've built these expensive towers, and you're not done, it sounds like. Are there any way to offset some of this cost? I mean, can those towers also serve dual purposes? I think we've asked that question. I just want to hear the answer again. I mean, could you rent parts of them? Could you use some of it for public television charge fee, those kind of things?
Mr. Chairman, in fact, there are FCC requirements as long as they do not create interference with the signals, we can work with those agencies, and in fact have worked with those agencies and public and private entities as well to share those facilities where we can.
How much of that's going on then today, and are you receiving any funds for that, any rent, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, we are not receiving any rent on this. This is kind of a back and forth. We do the same thing. We've tried to share facilities, and in fact we are trying to do that right now in the area, up in the Jackson area, and we're hoping not to have to pay anything. We haven't had to pay anything for sharing those facilities in the past, other than to pay power fees and that, and we reciprocate with those entities by doing the same as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a second. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to follow up on that a little bit. You said that we were sharing with both private and other agencies. If we're sharing with private companies and we're providing something of benefit, should we not be compensated for that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we're going both directions with that. We are using their facilities as well and putting WildLink on their towers inside of their buildings, as well as when we have that, when they come and ask us to use that. And so we work back and forth, but there are some FCC, I will have to look it up, but I believe there's some FCC regulations and requirements specific to this, and I will definitely look that up and get you an answer.
Mr. Chairman, going back to WildLink specific, so I'm contracting the conversation back for just a second here. No one is being billed for the services that WildLink provides, okay? And statutorily, we have the ability to bill the federal government in their use for it, but there was a quid pro quo established where they were able to obtain frequencies that we couldn't otherwise get our hands on. So that swap was there. Chip into the game.
Okay, Reverend Nicholas, did you have one?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I wonder if you can put together a short report for us on who you're sharing with. I would like to know what things interfere and don't interfere, and whether or not, and show us what your quid pro quos is so we can have an evaluation if you can add additional things, and if we're getting the biggest bang for our buck on how we're sharing it, just so we understand it better.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, change the subject just a little bit. I was curious, did get an email from Chief Police of the Fire Chief of Casper yesterday that was talking about how well the system worked in both the Shepherd's Hill Fire, which was a big fire we had in Casper Mountain, as well as the murder we had on Casper College. But I wanted to ask you about one thing that came up when there was, we've had a couple large fires on Castro Mountain, and my understanding is, and my belief is that the WildLink Tower is also on Casper Mountain. And I know that in not in the Shepherd's Hill, but the one we had a few years ago, the Jackson Canyon fire, that we came pretty, with the fire came probably with less than a mile from taking out Tower Hill, and which would have, only WildLink, but a lot of the other communications around Casper. I'm just wondering if that had happened, is there any redundancy in that system so that people would still be able to communicate with each other? Because that's, I mean, that's the umbrella that throws over my neck of the woods.
Mr. Chairman, to some degree there is some redundancy. Plus, we do have, in concert with Homeland Security, we have some portable towers that we could put in place to restore temporarily those sites after we can clear the fire site and get things back up until such time as we can get something rebuilt in that area. I wouldn't say that there would be 100% coverage, but there is some redundancy backfill coverage that we could provide with the other towers.
Go ahead.
So, but I mean, what would happen? I mean, if you lost that thing in a big fire, I mean, that's the event. And what would happen to the coordination among? I mean, you've got federal, you've got state, you've got multiple jurisdictions within our county, and not all of them are on the same frequency.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn this over to the chairman of the Public Safety Communications Commission, Mr. Steve Arshman, and he can tell you a little bit about this.
Okay, then we're going to wrap up on WildLink. Provide the summary, please.
And Senator, our system in that event has three redundancies. If we were to lose that tower on the mount, we revert to a tower that's on the top of the Hall of Justice. Our flexibility is diminished some, but our ability to communicate is still in place. And of course, from a strategic standpoint, I was in charge of that fire, and we put a lot of resources towards protecting that infrastructure. It would have been very difficult for us to lose that facility.
Okay, does that get your answer, Senator Perkins? Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that there's still a portion that is yet to be built out, and we've got this $5.66 million ongoing cost forever, apparently. And so the build out, is that coming out of that $8-9 million fund that we're getting pooled income off of, or where is that coming from?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there's $6.3 million as of the day that I wrote this report that is still currently available for that was originally appropriated for what we termed as phase two, which was the build out of WildLink. And I know that we've actually made some transactions since this report was done, so that's actually smaller than that. There's also things that you heard Mr. Schultz discuss about towers in particular places, and those are we were trying to identify that they're small pockets. They weren't originally in the plan, but we're trying to get the coverage in particular spaces and to meet those folks that would like to come onto the system. We do have some funding for the towers, the core towers, because if you recall, WildLink wasn't just generally funded. We had federal funds, and we had a contribution from the Transportation Commission of $23 million. And that $23 million was what the Transportation Commission always had before, and that was the core microwave towers. So we do have some money to facilitate some places that are in this year's commission budget, which we talked about a couple of months ago, that will address some towers in western Wyoming. And then what we're going to do is, like I previously said, we will be meeting with the Public Service, Public Safety Communications Commission, the governor's staff, and also YDOT to identify the needs and create alternatives and seek recommendations for this committee next time we meet in the supplemental process. And that will frame up what the needs will be for 2017 and 2018.
Go ahead.
Then my next question is that $8, $9 million fund, what's it for? What's it called? Where is it at?
Mr. Chairman, the fund that we have is in the Wyoming Online Financial System WOLS, and it's IO8. That's Internal Service Fund 8. And that's where the money is and has been for the appropriations, and that's where the transactions take place for the general fund budgets.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment. Sorry. I know you want to wrap this particular conversation up. With regard to the core system and the build-out of the core system, we do not intend to come to you asking for money in the future to add towers to the core system. We regard that as a Department of Transportation responsibility.
Okay. We've wild-linked ourselves to a point where we can move on. Anybody else? Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that takes us to Unit 0701 on page 98, and that would be the Aeronautics Administration. The Aeronautics Administration oversees the assistance of the airport infrastructure in the state of Wyoming. I will point out that YDOT does not own that infrastructure, but there's a large share of federal funding that the Department of Transportation receives, and the federal government puts us in place to assist that responsibility of that administration. On page 98 on the bottom, you will see that there is a request for two laptops. It's continued on page 99. And also on the bottom of page 99, you'll see that there's an ETS transfer of $69,552. Mr. Chairman, is there any questions on Aeronautics Administration?
Any questions, committee? 15 full-time.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we are actually on now page 104.
And good memory.
And that happens to be operations of aircraft. The operations aircraft account is IO6 in WOLVES, and this is where we manage the consumables to operate the aircraft. The Department of Transportation bills the other agencies $1,425 an hour to recover the cost of consumables. The pilot's salary for the operations aircraft was in a previous budget or in Aeronautics Administration.
Okay, how many pilots do we have? How many planes do we have?
Mr. Chairman, Dennis.
How old are they?
Aeronautics Division. We have 8 full-time pilots.
8?
8. We have 2 Cessna Citation aircraft for passenger use. The DOT also owns a Cessna Caravan, which is used almost exclusively for photogrammetry and survey stuff, highway-related stuff.
On the Caravan, do they utilize part of these 8 pilots, or do they have their own pilots?
They have their own pilot, single pilot.
So you have 8 pilots for 2 planes?
Correct.
Good. You got a Caravan, and how many pilots does YDOT have for the Caravan?
One pilot, Mr. Chairman.
One pilot. Okay. Continue. Are there any other airplanes?
That is it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We got YDOT's got, do you have a King Air as well? You don't have a King Air?
No, Mr. Chairman.
University has 2 King Airs. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct. I know that they have at least 1.
Okay. You know, and I read your report, too, on the analysis, and thanks for providing that. The question on, you know, when you look at these jets and the mission they have, they're the wrong type of plane for what they're doing in Wyoming with all the cycles. So the question I have is, and when you look at those planes, you know, that they're not worth very much money today at all. What's the lifespan? Have they had their hot sections? What are we looking at in terms of replacement of those? Are we going to continue? How many hours are on them? What's that all look like?
Mr. Chairman, I had our new flight operations manager, Tori Meisel, who's with us here today, do some analysis with regard to the aircraft. we can maintain 95% reliability easily for the next 7 to 12 years with those aircraft. Now, one thing, Mr. Chairman, that I would disagree with in that statement is that those aren't the right aircraft for our mission. I think that it's my opinion, I believe that it's Tory's opinion, and you would have seen it in that report, too, that these aircraft are uniquely suited for this environment. And I think that they give us levels of safety beyond what a turboprop would. Not that.
We're gonna hopefully. You gotta go somewhere.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, wait to see you.
That was my left arm and right leg. Yeah, sorry, I got that incorrect.
Oh yeah.
But, I feel there's a. I'm looking for the camera and waiting for somebody to jump out. So yeah, the joke.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, I do believe that we can utilize the currently. Do you mind if I just take your? Thanks, Kevin. I think somebody was messing with me. Mr. Chairman, I do think that. Utilizing those the aircraft that we currently have for the next 7 to 12 years, in my opinion, is the best thing to do in terms of getting full life out of those assets that we've already paid for. We do get layers of safety with those aircraft. As you well know, they perform better in our environments in terms of one engine climb out, especially in the mountainous areas in Jackson and some of those other areas. So, Mr. Chairman, although new planes sound nice, I really think that we can continue to utilize these two jet aircraft for the next 7 to 12 years very effectively and efficiently.
Yeah, well, the mistake was made when we bought them. I think I would disagree with you totally. I think a King Air is a better application for the mission in Wyoming, but we can agree to disagree on that. On the 7 to 12 years, could you provide some cost estimates? You know, when you do your cost per hour of $1,400, you know, mm-hmm. Does that reflect engine reserve? Does that reflect hot sections? Does that reflect the true operating cost? Or is that just, I mean, you know, you can play with these numbers all you want, but you got to have amount of money divided by reasonable hours right. To come up with true operating costs.
Right. It does include some of the costs that you mentioned, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to provide you the details of that, but it is not a total cost of operation. It is not total operating cost.
Yeah, we really need to know what... You know, $1,400 to run those jets is not what it costs an hour.
Mr. Chairman, our initial analysis, and it actually matches up with what we're seeing from information on industry averages, and I'm looking for those numbers here now.
And while you're looking, the other issue is the cycles, and I'm not familiar with pure jet engines that much, but you get into the cycle issue, and you're probably at some point in time going to have to buy brand-new engines. And how does that phase into the next 7 to 12 years? You can only overhaul them so many times. And so that's what I'm looking at. You don't need to try to answer that.
You bet. We can put
but
that
I
together.
Want to know really what the heck it's going to cost us and what we need to do.
We have all that information. So what I'll do is put it in a format that's easily read through.
It's real easy for me. It costs X amount of money per year divided by the amount of hours you think you're going to fly. That's a simple way.
We can easily put that together for you.
And then eight pilots for two planes with the utilization that you have seems like an overkill. Why eight pilots?
Mr. Chairman, our utilization right now is down a bit. We could probably get by with seven pilots, but we have seen a bit of a cyclical climb and decline in the use of the aircraft, and that's has specifically correlated to agency budgets and their ability to utilize those aircraft. So could we get by with less pilots? We could, but I do think that there would be at least a small decrease in our availability for flights.
The other thing, if you were to sell those pilots and just eliminate this program, what would we get for those planes? And could you provide that to me, an idea what they might be worth?
If we continue with the programs that we have now, Power Advantage Plus and... Power Advantage and Parts Plus, and go through the overhaul, they'd be worth about $2.5 million apiece. But they'd be worth less than that if we didn't keep those programs associated with those aircraft.
And that type of aircraft for that mission, if you were to buy a new one, they're what, $7 to $10 million now?
Yes.
Is that pretty much what they are?
That would be the range, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anybody have any other questions on the Representative Wallace?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been tossing back and forth this term, the mission. What is the mission of these aircraft?
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
It's to transport both government officials and state employees back and forth for work-related business.
Mr. Co-Chair.
So, like, for example, like Director Cox, you talked about you went to Washington, D.C. for 3 days. Was one of these planes used, or did you fly commercial?
Mr. Chairman, I flew commercial. I personally use the plane maybe four times a year, and that's all. I fly commercial. I've never flown them. I've never flown on the jet. I take that back. Back when I was at the patrol, we did have an out-of-state flight on the jet, but it's used. The lion's share of the use is in-state, at least for the state agencies themselves.
Mr. Chairman, just and then on these Encores, what are the passenger load on? Was it an 8-passenger, 10-passenger?
9 and 11, Mr. Chairman.
9 and 11, Mr. Chairman. So, and some of your narrative talks about kind of working with other agencies to. Can you get us the data on how full they are? Kind of your average per flight. I mean, what we hear from constituents is. All our money is to fly an engineer up to some part of the state for 8 hours and fly him home for supper that night. And we think, geez, the rest of working Wyoming goes and stays for a couple of days, does the work, and drives home.
Yeah.
So that's the stuff that you hear out there, and I just want to kind of get the scoop from you while we got you here.
We can certainly do that, Mr. Put it together for Nashville, but I can give you some just anecdotally here that we don't send that aircraft up, especially internally with the DOT, with one person on it. It's not efficient. It's not effective. Unless it's an emergency of some kind, you know, there are caveats. But as a general rule of business, that is not how those aircraft are used. We try to put as many people on those aircraft as possible. And we also try to, I think we've done a good job at this. We have combined agencies whenever we can. So if one agency is taking a flight on a Wednesday, and another agency needs it Wednesday afternoon, we try to coordinate so to see if we can get both of those agencies on that flight, one flight, to reduce our overall operating costs, reduce the cost to the state. So we try to utilize those aircraft as absolutely as efficiently as we can because we understand how profile they are.
So just to represent Wallace's mission, Mr. Chairman, so the mission is to transport YDOT employees to and from. I think that's what you said. Just repeat that again. So
I didn't
see it listed in here anywhere.
Mr. Chairman, it's not just YDOT. It's all state government. So all of the agencies, including the governor's office, and we have had legislative committees and legislators themselves travel on those aircraft for boards and commissions as well, travel on those aircraft. So it is not just YDOT's usage of the aircraft, although we are the biggest user.
And most of those, Mr. Chairman, most of those flights, just from our conversation, they're virtually all in-state.
The vast majority are in-state. Now, I do know that some agencies have utilized the aircraft, and recently it hit the paper, used state aircraft, the University of Wyoming did, to do some football work, basically recruitment work outside of the agency.
And they used your plane and paid for it.
Yes.
And Mr. Co-Chair, and I looked at that report you gave me, and I'm just trying to remember, but it seems that the highest utilization for those planes are like three to five people. Three people to five people, I think, is about 60, 70, 80% of the time. You know, very seldom are they full. Okay, yes, Representative Stubson.
And, Mr. Chairman, to that point, I mean, is there any mechanism, if I'm a state employee and I know I've got to go to Jackson, that I can check in and see if there's a plane heading there and hitch a ride if it's already going?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is. We have a website, the DOT's website. On that website is the schedule and contact information. You can also see if the aircraft is going somewhere that day and where it's going.
Okay, anything else on the Senator Meyer?
That schedule, how far back does it go historically, 10, 12, 20 years?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure we have records back that far. I don't know if that particular schedule goes back that far, but I know we have records that go back that far.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you had a little hiccup, and you know what I'm talking about, and those things happen about that. And And you know, that's what happens, and I think we all learn from that. So
yes,
that's over and behind us. Anything else on aeronautics? And get those numbers to me, because I'd like to have some more discussion with you. And,
sure.
And the cycles and those kinds of things are some concerns I have. John?
Mr. Co-Chair, relative to your questions about state employee use of the planes, I don't know what the practice is in other agencies. I do know that the governor's clear message to the agencies, all of us, was that he wanted the use of the planes closely scrutinized by every single agency. For our purposes in the DOT, the decision as to who uses the plane and for what are made at the program level. So it has to have typically two clicks of supervisory approval in order to use it.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there was probably a very high probability that Dennis probably could have just stayed right here for the near future. But at any rate, on page 107, we can talk about the Airport Improvement Program, which is Unit 1001. The first priority, priority number 5 on the bottom of page 107, we're asking for $7.8 million to meet the expectations of federal revenue that we anticipate to receive in 15 and 16. This last fiscal period, we did do a B-11 to also incorporate that additional federal revenue into the airport improvement program that is used for the local government assets, the airports. And it's our best understanding at this point in time that that's kind of going to be the trend for the upcoming biennium, but we don't know. It's just a really difficult thing to stake a ground in on federal funds. But the trend and what we believe is that in 15 and 16, our current standard budget for federal funds is going to be short by about $7.8 million.
You know, and maybe this is a question for Dennis as well on the airport improvements, and that's the category of the budget we're in. You know, are we really dictated by what the feds want us to do to these airports? You can make some pretty good arguments if you look at, and I'm a pilot, so I'm a little tainted in my observations, but I look at some of the money we spend, and not picking on Hot Springs County, but, you know, we're going to spend I don't know how many millions to move that airport in another area when there's probably other needs. How has that worked? Do the feds drive how we spend the federal dollars, the 90-10 and the local matches, or is it something that's generated from the local airports, or is this, just tell me how that works.
Mr. Chairman, just let me answer that in two ways. One, the federal decision to spend federal dollars in the end is up to them. However, we have established a very good process in terms of developing our WASUP, which is very similar to the STIF that you folks see on the highway project side. And so we go through a number of steps. We talk to the locals and determine from them what projects they think are important to the airport. We have our own ideas from the state side of what projects we think are important to the state and to those airports. And then, of course, the feds have their own ideas about what's important. So then those three entities get together, and we sit down and hash out basically our differences and really kind of come to a compromise or an agreement on what projects should be completed. That's how the process works.
And I can only go by things that have happened in the past. And I look at Riverton, and the airport's been, it's on that hill, and it's been that way for, I don't know, tens of years. And so there was a decision made to knock down one end and raise the other by 2 degrees or something. And in the big scheme of things, in terms of safety, I don't think it made any sense. Was that driven by the river people in Riverton saying that we ought to do this? Was that driven by a federal issues? Tell me how something like that happens. And if it does happen that way, what kind of input can the local people have?
It was, I think, driven by federal requirements, design standards requirements. Although,
so they were going to lose their federal dollars if they didn't comply with a 1 degree and 1 percentage grade and some of those things.
That would be an extreme case, and they never said those words exactly, but that's always a risk when you don't, you know, obviously do what the feds want with their money. Now, to talk about that project just a little bit, Mr. Chairman. It's a design standards issue. It is a safety issue by definition. The degree of safety, I think, is what people can debate in terms of how unsafe or how much safer is the runway now. But it was going to impact any commercial traffic in there, especially long-term. And so our office was not opposed to that project, and I think you'll see the phase two coming up here pretty soon. So we raised one side, and now we're going to be lowering the other side here probably in this next fiscal – beginning in this next fiscal period.
Okay. Anybody have any other questions? Okay. That's it. For now, I guess, or keep going through your budget.
I guess we've had a sit here, Mr. Chairman.
It's called a forward pass.
Yes.
Or maybe it's a backward lateral. Go ahead.
Thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chairman. The next one would be on page 112. It's unit 1002, and it's the Air Service Enhancement Assistant Program.
Okay. Is this where you're asking for less money?
Less than we could have, Mr. Chairman, yes. Any questions, Mr. Chairman?
Well, yeah, go through the budget.
Okay, so basically, Mr. Chairman, what we're asking for is an exceptional request of $3.798 million. Now, that's the way we developed this exception request was based on the philosophy of keeping the service we currently had or keeping the service that current Air Service Enhancement grant money was assisting in at the time. So that information you can see is at the bottom of 112. That's what the state's portion of the existing grants were at the time we developed the exception request. So if you factored in those biennium costs, the current biennium costs, plus the current standard biennium budget of $2.88 million, we were short $3.798 million in keeping what we had. So keeping what we had was Cody, Jackson, Rock Springs, and Gillette, those services in those communities. Now, of that $3.798 million, and you heard Kevin talk about this a little bit, that fund, the Air Service Enhancement account, accrues interest. So we took that into account. There was $160,394 that had accrued in interest in that account. So to pay for the $3.798 million, we were asking for $3.638 million in general funds and then the interest of $160,394 in pooled funds.
Can you? That's it?
That's it on that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I heard that right. So this exception request is not to expand service. It's simply to maintain our current subsidies to keep these carriers in these towns of Cody, Gillette, Rock Springs, and Jackson.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And I think it would be a good time to mention that given the current state of air service across the nation, not just in Wyoming, that this next year Cheyenne will be in risk of not making its 10,000 employments. Now, the impact of that is that they will – if they don't make their 10,000 employments, they will lose $850,000 in federal funding. So the money that we're asking for doesn't take the situation in Cheyenne in account. And the same is true. Let me take one step back. Sheridan is also in a situation where their air service is in pretty bad shape. And I do know that Sheridan would like to participate in this program. Unfortunately, the funds aren't available to support both Sheridan and Cheyenne and keep what we have. So this is just to keep what we have, but there are certainly additional needs out there.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
How did you, I mean, and as you look at that situation, just as a person doesn't know really anything about this other than flying on airplanes, but it's all these towns that are on the borders really that have this leakage issue that have less employments, I would think. I mean, just it's 90 miles from here to DIA to get the, you know, to compare fares. You're sitting in Casper, Riverton, it's a little different story. You're going to have to drive a ways. And so I guess I don't know what our, is the goal to keep the employments up to get the federal money, or is the goal obviously to keep air service robust in Wyoming? Is it to prevent leakage? Is it to get the most people we can in Wyoming, the cheapest fares? I mean, what are all the, what's the goal or the mission, I guess?
The goal of the Air Service Enhancement Program is to have robust air service in the state. We do that a couple of ways. One is, and the most important way to do that is to reduce the leakage. To reduce the leakage, you have to work primarily on three things. Now, there's more factors than just these three, but these are the three most important factors. Those are fares, reliability, and schedules. So we work very hard with the airlines that we are currently under contract with to make sure that fares are on, our average fares are comparable to the competing airports outside of the state. We also work with them on providing the best schedules for the customer's needs. And we also contract with them to maintain high reliability, so industry standard reliability numbers, on-time performance and reliability.
But so Mr. Chairman,
that's all, Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Chairman, is there a, I mean, could you show us a cost benefit, like the Cheyenne example? You said they're in risk of losing, it was $10
million? $850,000.
Oh, $850,000. Mm-hmm. So is there a, I mean, some of the enhancements, I don't know, how much money does it take to help Cheyenne then? To how much do we have to spend to save $850,000?
A lot. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we would lose the $850,000, but I need to add that there is a much larger economic impact to good air service, sure, rather than just the $850,000. So that is definitely measurable, the $850,000. We can also go back and show you what we invested when Cheyenne had the Dallas service and the additional incremental economic dollars that came into the city based on that service. I don't have those numbers right off the top of my head. It's kind of rough, but I think we spent about $2.4 million, and if I remember correctly, there was an additional increased economic benefit of about $12
million. So, Mr. Chairman, just kind of the last deal on this, just kind of we did our math on the – on the deal, just looking at our current program, I mean, folks in Gillette enjoy about a $19 subsidy on their airline ticket each way. Rock Springs, $22 or so. Just it varies on those communities. But I would think the other piece of this is somehow incentivizing folks to start. There's probably startup cost of, you know, and Casper used to have direct to Chicago and direct to Minneapolis. We've lost those. I don't know why. But is there's no money in this budget then to encourage some kind of startup to get a Casper to Chicago going again?
Mr. Chairman, no, not in this budget. There is not.
And so we're simply in the subsidy business now. We're just trying to keep what we got, and we're trying to make fares.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I would quantify it as subsidy. We're paying for a service.
Okay.
If they perform better than expected, we pay less. So theoretically, we could get to a point where that we pay nothing. Now, because of the increased fuel costs and because of the increased demand for the available aircraft that exist today, across the nation, there is way more opportunity for the airlines than they have the equipment to provide. So we have a little bit of a competition issue here, and it's only going to get worse. So it's not a subsidy. It really is pay for service, and if they perform better than expected, we pay less, and at some point maybe nothing. But given the environment that we're currently operating within, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that is going to be a reality in the short term. I might mention here that this is the new reality, especially for communities like those the size of the ones that Wyoming has. There has been over 30 communities that have lost service, a number of communities that will continue to lose service that are about the size of those that we have here in Wyoming, and that will continue to be the trend. So the bottom line is, in many of our cases, with the exception of Jackson and maybe Casper, if you want air service, you're going to have to pay for it. That's the bottom line. I don't think that anybody's happy about that, but that's the reality that we're facing.
Okay.
Yeah, the other thing, Mr. Chairman, is you just take a flight if you want to go to Denver, and Cheyenne, if you want to go like a nonstop to Dallas out of Denver, you can probably get a round trip ticket for like $300. and you've got a pretty good reliability factor. If you want to fly out of Cheyenne, it goes up considerably, and there's nothing you can subsidize that will change that. Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be the way it is. It's not going to change. The other thing that I have problems with this program on is how you really justify and come to a number. I mean, you can show enplanements, you can show percentages and these kinds of things, but you look at Jackson, you know, it's incredible what's gone on up there. I mean, I don't think they even need any subsidy. I think the amount they had is so small. And I look at Riverton, where we've got some real issues with air service. I wish you had an answer on how we could deal with that. The biggest problem we have is two things. It's the aircraft, and it's the crazy FAA ruling that says that co-pilots have to have 1,500 hours. So it's strictly a matter of people. You're not going to find people that's got 1,500 hours that are going to want to fly right seat in a Beech 1900. How do you try to quantify this subsidy to try to deal with that issue? If there's a way, then I'm all on board with this, but I don't think you can.
Mr. Chairman, there is a way. We contract with a provider that can provide better on-time performance and provide better reliability, but that costs money. That costs money. And we don't have money in the account right now to be able to do that. But if you want to reduce leakage, if you want to have robust air service in your community, you have to be dealing with a provider who is willing to work on comparable fares, on-time performance and reliability, and provide good schedules. There has to be a willingness to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, in the ultimate, and I think we had a study that says we'll subsidize and have our own airlines within the state, and that was such a big, huge disaster. I mean, that's where you try to find the balance between that's being really stupid.
Correct.
And then try to do the subsidies, and I just can't see how you quantify the benefits based on the amount of money we're spending. So I guess we can agree to disagree on that one, too.
Mr. Chairman, what I can do is provide you with more information, at least, and in terms of the impact that we are making. Now, other committees have had the benefit of this, the information that I'm talking about, presentations, joint minerals, joint transportation, the Select Committee on Air Transportation. We have provided them substantial information, and we have been a little remiss in not providing as much information to this committee. We can rectify that, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be happy to provide that information to you in a narrative and an easy to understand. Here's the difference. Here are the benefits that the Air Service Enhancement Program are providing to the communities that are involved in the program. I can show you quantifiable progress, and progress that where the return on investment is higher. It's not
negative.
And
I've seen some of those reports, and they talk about the enplanements and things going up, but they don't quantify in an engineering perspective how you can justify where you kick in the enhancement monies and how that makes a difference. And that's what I'm looking for. Okay. I'm not looking for just the fact that they're up or down. How you can incrementally show that money affected and going into that market does have that difference. And air service is so important to our state. I mean, that's one of the biggest things we've got to combat, and it's only going to get worse. You're so right. And we go to these RJs, you know, if you put on your crystal ball and try to look forward 8, 10, 12, 15 years down the road, I don't know what's going to happen. All the Brasilias and these other planes, the 1900s, are going to be so antiquated, and RJs are a thing of the future. But how are you going to have a 35-passenger RJ, you know, flying out of Worland? I mean, some of the things just are not going to happen. So,
correct.
You know, what we're doing is we got a Band-Aid, you know, at best, and what's going on, and maybe we need to take a more global look at there's some other things we might do. Don't know what that might be, but, you know, it's only going to get worse.
Mr. Chairman, we have taken a broader look. We've taken a more comprehensive look at this. We've worked with a number of airlines to fix probably, I'm using round numbers here, 95% of the air service ills in the state. Unfortunately, that comes with a price tag, too, and that price tag is somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $18 million per year. The governor was involved in doing some, his office was involved in doing some of the early initial investigation into a more comprehensive solution, and I think that the price tag is just, it's substantial. It's a lot more money than we're talking about here, and I'm not sure that this is the time to do that. That's not my decision. I just don't know if that kind of money exists. But we have taken a broader look for sure at this. And you're right. Given the finances that we currently have, it is a Band-Aid. And it's going to get tougher to continue to get that Band-Aid to work.
And the other thing, and Mr. Co-Chair, you talked about how nice it is to have a nonstop flight out of Casper to Dallas or Chicago, and I agree with that. But as a state, we have to come to grips with reality, and we have to look at to Denver, Salt Lake, Rapid City, Billings.
I agree, Mr.
Idaho
Chairman.
Idaho Falls or whatever, and so.
Those would be our focuses, would be Denver and Salt Lake right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Director Byrne, just looking at the current level of support that you have there, I want to make sure my understanding is correct. Because now, for example, Cody, you don't have a contract in place right now that obligates you to pay $574 for the next 2 years, do you?
No, we do not, Mr. Chairman. That's just forecast based on the contract that was in place at the time we put this together.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming then that each of these has their own contract with their own length of term that's involved that has to be either renegotiated or, and that each of these programs outlined here, they have to be reauthorized or there has to be a new grant application every time that happens. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So over the next biennium, if we provide these funds, I mean, is this in rock, or do each of these communities have to justify those continuing expenditures going forward? And so we might see a change in applications and who's receiving support.
Mr. Chairman, there's always the chance that you might see a change in who is, but the commission is focused right now on making sure that these communities that we've helped in the past don't lose the service that they currently have. So while theoretically you might see some changes, if the money didn't change, then it would likely still be these folks.
Okay, Dennis, any other questions? Any other questions on this? One other comment is, and I read the management audit report and appreciate your complying. I think we're in pretty good shape there with what they came up with and your reaction to it. So thanks for doing that.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, you have one thing left. It's the $50 million one. Am I right?
Mr. Chairman.
Page 104.
Yeah. Actually, we spoke about it already, and I'll just advise real quickly. There is the Air Service Enhancement Administration position that we talked about earlier. That's on the next pages, but that's 103, 115. And then you have highways. There's an original request from the Department of Transportation for $50 million, and the governor has recommended denial. His comments were, in light of revenues received as a result of the increase in the state fuel tax, I recommend denial of $50 million in general fund service transportation.
Any questions? The $46 million that's in your standard budget, how long has that been at that level? Page 122, 0701.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, at the level of $46 million, that's actually only been there as recent as this particular budget because we received a $2 million biennialization of this standard budget. As it is written today, we did have a 2014 original cut of $2 million. So prior to that, we had a $50 million standard budget, and that was in place for a while. But if you go back to 2009, we actually had a $200 million standard budget, and it's gone down now to $46 million biennium.
And that was $200 million in 2009?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions, committee? Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Cox, I haven't found it, and I don't know if Don's found it since then, but some reports on your 600 and 900 series.
Mr. Chairman, I did provide that report, I think, about 2 days ago. LSO should have that to you. Sandy has a hard copy if you'd like to have one.
Well, just get it to us in SharePlus, I guess.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I can beg the indulgence of the committee just for one last house cleaning item.
Sure.
The Historically, since about 1999, the Department of Transportation has requested the legislature provide us $100 million worth of borrowing authority. And that's to support our cash flow. And a example would be what we have been faced with federal funds and threats of federal government closures, et cetera. So with $100 million worth of borrowing authority, we can keep rural construction projects going until such time as the feds reopen the doors and start paying us again. We do expect them to pay us for what we spend, and it's appreciated if the committee will approve that again in the 300 sections of the budget.
We have that 300. You're talking about Section 300 series? Yeah.
Yeah, and I believe that, Don, you have.
Don's got that? Yeah. I don't. Yeah, we'll sure. We'll take a look at that. Okay, committee, anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here, and good presentation as always, and we look forward to working with you in the future. I don't anticipate a callback. Don, if we have any questions, we'll get a hold of you and let you know. And what do you think, Mr. Co-Chair? Come back about 1 and wrap it up for the day? Okay, we will be back at 1.